Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. The war on poverty, the 50th anniversary just passed, but the corporatists and the GOP shills still attacking the poor. We'll take a look at some of the things the rest of us should be focusing on. Turn away from the shiny thing. Turn off the fake news. Break the American Idol schmuck dynasty addiction. Lay off the Soma. One of those things from my high school years. Got to read the book Brave New World. If you remember, the Soma was the it was a drug that they took, intoxicating, psychoactive drug that they, if I remember right, was they described as something that had all the benefits of Christianity without and alcohol without their defects. So interesting stuff there. We'll talk about that. Also, we're going to dive into why the governor should take the Medicaid expansion money and what it's going to mean for hundreds of thousands of Pennsylvanians in the event that our governor doesn't. Again, this is another reason come November he's got to go. The priorities that this guy has shown us that he has, I don't think are in line with the vast majority of us. Even if he were to take the Medicaid expansion money today, it would still be months, if not a year from now, before the working poor of this state got the help that they needed. And the rest of us get the benefits that we would have gotten as well by making sure everyone has health insurance. Because there's a lowering effect of all of our costs by everyone being insured. And by making sure that people aren't going to the most expensive mode of delivery when they get sick. It just makes sense to me. Also going to talk about the minimum wage. Maybe we should be looking at a maximum wage. What do you think? Or at least a tax code that discourages unmitigated greed. Just a thought. We'll look into that. Your thoughts, your questions, your comments, whatever's on your mind. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. You can also email me during the program, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So today, the song and dance, the distraction, the show, however you want to put it, Bridge Ghazi, Bridgegate. did Chris Christie know that his flacks were planning to shut down a couple of lanes on the George Washington Bridge to make everyone in that region's life miserable? And as one of the emails, to me, the most egregious part of all this whole thing were some of the communications in the emails. And I don't know if you've got to read some of the more outrageous ones, but the one line that got me is one of the people said, I feel sorry for the kids on the school buses who aren't going to get up to school on time, who are going to be stuck in traffic for hours. I feel sorry for them. And the other person chimes back, well, they're, this Baroni guy's voters. So that's their punishment for voting for someone other than us. And to me, look, I watched an hour and 42 minutes of the what seemed like forever press conference, and I give Christie credit for standing up there and taking the beating, but he stuck to his talking points. Talking point one, oh, poor, poor, pitiful me. I didn't know they lied to me, and I'm sad. I'm sad that they lied to me, that my person lied to me. The other one is, I run a very large organization. I can't know what everyone else is doing. Did you hear that? Because what's interesting? All of the Republicans who are now circling the wagons around Christie to defend him, they're the ones who pointed Obama and say, well, he should have known about Benghazi, and he should have known about the IRS, and he should have known about every single little thing that happens. And he's in charge of a couple million employees, as were, Christie says 65,000. So I find it interesting. Now, can he know everything all at once? No. Do I personally think he ordered this? Absolutely not. I don't. I think this is kind of Bush League. I think that he would want, I think he's the kind of bully that would want you to know that he was doing something to you. If he was stabbing you, he'd want you. I think he's the kind of bully who'd want you to know that this is the punishment and I did it to you and there's nothing you can do. Now, the people that are attracted to someone like him, I don't know, are as strong willed maybe as he is, or as direct They're the little backbiters and the little ankle biters who would pull something bush league and nonsensical and ridiculous and punitive like this. Now, my problem is you've got the Republicans who have been telling us, well, government doesn't work. You see, they can turn to this and say, see, it doesn't work, so we shouldn't have it. Nonsense. We should be criminally prosecuting the people who did this as far up as it goes. And I know a lot of people want to point the finger at Christie, and I do too, to an extent. Just because these are the people that he hired. These are the people that are in his world. And these are the kind of people who run Republican-run government. And it's not just New Jersey. It's here in Pennsylvania, too. When you get a governor like Corbett, you get a governor like Christie or LePage or Walker or any of them, what you're getting are people who hate government, don't believe in it, don't want it to succeed or work, and then do everything they can possibly do to muck it up. So even if things turned badly there, what they end up having is a situation where, see, it's government's fault. Blame the Turnpike Commission. Blame the mayor of Fort Lee. Blame the governor. So I just find it interesting. And I'd be interested in your thoughts. If you watched the Apology Tour or the Poor Pitiful Me Tour, I'd be interested in the thoughts and the ideas. Maybe you see it a little differently than I do. I don't know that this is going to hurt him in his bid for the presidency. I think he's polarized to a large extent. You've got people who are going to vote for him no matter what he does. He could gut somebody in public, and they'd still vote for him. And you got people on the other side who are going to vote against him because he is a bully. My concern is that he's going to pull some of those really hardcore conservative Democrats who used to be moderate Republicans or because they want that tough guy, even though his policies are well, they're horrible. It just is what it is. Before we move along, I kind of... This just came across my desk. It looks like, according to the Wall Street Journal, it looks like the fast track, and according to Reuters, it looks like the fast track for the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement is being sought in the Senate. It looks like Max Backdoras, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, this kind of trade bill would emanate from. It looks like he, along with Orrin Hatch and Representative Dave Camp, the Republican chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, it looks like they've joined Backdoras and to push this fast-track authority. Now, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, as we've been saying for years on this program, is nothing more than the NAFTA, really hyper steroided NAFTA. I mean, the giant size, the supersized NAFTA. And you look at the countries that are in it, and I was joking before we went on air that I'm going to have to get someone to give me the phonetic pronunciation of some of the countries. I think it's Burundi, B-R-U-N-E-I, Burundi. I think good luck finding that on the map. Also, Chile, New Zealand, Singapore, they're the ones that back in 2005 were the original signatories of the Bush Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. And then in 2008, Bush got Australia, Peru, Vietnam, all them on board in 2008. And then, of course, during the year 2010, Malaysia came on, then Mexico and Canada and Japan and Taiwan, and then South Korea, I guess, last year is going to be in it. And then there's a part of this that is like an add-on feature to where once we pass this, we won't have to worry about arguing about it anymore because there's like a Me Too agreement that will just bring people on. So even if we do get a vote in Congress on these treaties, which is what's supposed to happen, it'll be one of the last ones because of this add-on feature. Now, we don't get to know what's all in this. There are 600... special interests, lobbyists, 600 of these special interest lobbyists who have access to this, or I think they call them trade advisors, which is a nice word, isn't it? It's a step up from lobbyist, right? But they're the industry flacks who, you know, they've all got their own special interest and they're all fighting for that little slice of their pie. And do you know whose slice they're taking? Ours. Because I think our trade agreements have, over time, shown us exactly what is important to the 600 special interest lobbyists. And they're definitely not yours, your interest, or mine. It's not about creating good-paying jobs here. It's not about economic security or stability here. It's about more profit for the big corporations. It's about deregulation. It's about the free flow of capital across borders. And it's about making sure that that capital is protected. That's the part that gets me. And they say, oh, well, we're going to try and make sure that, you know, if people sign it, they're not going to manipulate their currency. Yeah, and isn't that kind of what we had with China and other countries? There are laws on the books. We just don't enforce them. So, again, it's another one of these moments where you go, American worker, can you possibly compete with a Vietnamese worker who's making 75 cents an hour? Can you possibly compete with... Now, look, what we hear from the right is we need to have lower wages, lower taxes, less benefits, all that stuff, but less regulation. So stop and think about the world that they're envisioning us to become when they're putting us in a direct agreement, a one-to-one agreement with a country like Vietnam, with a country like Burundi, you know, Malaysia, I mean, Taiwan. You go down the list and you go, the working conditions in many of these countries, deplorable. The wage condition, deplorable. So who benefits from this? You know, I've been using the Cicero phrase, cui bono, who benefits, to whose benefit? Because it's not my benefit. It's not your benefit. It's not the American workforce's benefit. It's Wall Street's benefit. And even then, it's just a small, small segment of Wall Street that benefits. And I hope, I know Sanders Levin, the Democrat from Michigan, is one of the people trying to stop it. I know Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont, and Sherrod Brown, the senator from Ohio, and I'm sure the senator from Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren, there'll be voices to try and stop this. But it's going to take you. It's going to take me. It's going to take all of us. Because this is bad all the way around. There's no good in this agreement. Well, I shouldn't say that because I don't know what's in it. I've only known what's been leaked. And everything that's been leaked has been bad. And I have to ask the other question. If they're hiding it, if it's all in secret, and like Alan Grayson said to me, I can't tell you what's in it. I've seen it, can't tell you. Sworn to secrecy. If that's the case, I don't want any part of it. That simple. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Pennsylvania State Representative Pat Harkin. Stick around. Right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. On the 50th anniversary of President Lyndon B. Johnson's war on poverty, the U.S. Senate is closer to extending unemployment benefits for another 3 months for long-term jobless workers. A few Republicans have joined the Democrats to vote to advance the legislation. Republicans, though, are trying to get more budget cuts in return for
extending the benefits. President Obama is urging Congress to extend the jobless benefits. The official poverty rate was 19% during the Johnson administration, and it's 15% now. Right-wing conservatives fought the anti-poverty programs then and continue to oppose them now. But even with the opposition, that limited the effectiveness of the war on poverty. Tens of millions of people have still been lifted out of poverty. According to the Census Bureau, anti-poverty programs kept 41 million Americans out of poverty in 2012. These programs include food assistance, unemployment compensation, Social Security, and earned income tax credits. About 1,200 French workers are losing their jobs at a Goodyear plant, and they're not happy with the severance pay. They held two managers captive for a few hours, threatening to detain them until the company agreed to pay out big severance amounts to the workers. The unions representing the workers want the equivalent of $110,000 in severance pay, plus about $3,400 per each year worked. French police freed the managers, but the French government doesn't severely prosecute these manager abductions, seeing them as acts of desperation and not as serious felony crimes of kidnapping as they would be treated in the U.S. After the managers were freed, workers continued their protests at the plant, including burning about 100,000 euros worth of Goodyear tires. When a plant closes in France, the entire international operation of the owner of the plant is taken into account when it comes to how the closing is handled. French workers have used the capture the boss and hold them tactic several times over the years as one of many tactics to win better compensation or working conditions. The Workers' Organizing Committee of Chicago helped Snarf sandwich shop workers protest what they say are unfair terminations of workers. The rally Wednesday at 2 Prudential Plaza in Chicago demanded the reinstatement of the fired workers and furlough payments. All of the workers at the Snarfs at 600 West Chicago were fired December 22nd. They were fired by email without notice just 3 days before Christmas. The St. Louis Show Me 15 campaign staged a protest in solidarity with the Chicago action and with the fired Chicago Snarf workers on Wednesday. Snarf is a national sandwich shop chain. The workers have filed NLRB complaints. Hundreds of supporters have called on Snarf to reinstate the workers.
This is a very sad day for 100,000 workers who are wondering what their future will hold.
We cannot afford to lose this fight. This is the end of everything that we built over 75 years.
Say if a machine breaks down, they would actually take gray duct tape to tape it up.
Listener support is vital to keep these worker voices on the radio news airwaves. Support Workers Independent News now by donating at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I am so pleased to be your governor, and I ask you to give me your support as I run for governor again, because I am running for governor of Pennsylvania.
Hit the road, Jack. Don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more. Hit the road, Jack. And don't you come back no more.
What you say?
Well, I got to tell you, I'm glad he's happy to be governor. I don't know many people that are happy he's governor. His approval ratings in the tank. And I think that that all goes back to the priorities that this governor's had since he's taken office. Gutting education, gutting health and human services, gutting investment in the future of our state. All so we can have more tax breaks, more handouts for the very well-to-do. It just seems to me very much so misplaced priorities. And the fact that he still has not come forth with his plan under the Affordable Care Act and this Medicaid expansion scheme that he's dreamt up, which, you know, in other states that have tried some of these, they've already turned them down. So there's part of me thinks he knows that. This is just another in a long list of delay tactics. But the question is, what's the coming year going to bring us? What are the priorities of this governor? What are the priorities of the Republican-controlled legislature, the House and the Senate? Here to help us work through some of that, our friend, Pennsylvania Representative Pat Harkin. Pat, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you for having me.
Good holiday season?
Oh, very nice. Very relaxing. Other than the cold temperatures and snow, everything went really well.
Good. Now it's time to get back to work, because I see tons of attacks on the horizon. There's talk of screwing with state workers again. There's talk of right to work. There's talk of all kinds of attacks on just average everyday work people who just want to go to work, do their jobs, and raise their families. And yet you've got this big money from outside the state leading these attacks, in my view.
Well, I think the election calendar will dictate what happens. Sadly. And I think priority number one for everybody is going to be the budget. You hear the governor and his people preaching gloom and doom right now, but I think they have a plan where they're going to they've got some things up their sleeve, and I hope that the public's ready for it. I look at the transportation bill that was passed before we left, and that was a talk that put the burden on the taxpayers again.
Yeah, you know, I the transportation bill, while, you know, it's a step in the right direction, I don't think it was anywhere near enough.
No, and we could have done something that it's not all on the backs of the working person. I was the UPS driver for 25 years. I knew many independents still do. I drive 80 every week back and forth to Harrisburg and Philly. And the people that I run into, they're the ones that got shafted again. The CDL charges are going up. The registration charges are going up. Tolls and everything else. None of the businesses were asked to share in the burden. And it's similar to what they do with the Marcellus Shale. No tax on the industry.
Yeah, I mean, it's on a number of levels, distressing, but again, it comes back down to the priorities. There's plenty of money to hand out to these corporate special interests who they claim are going to create jobs. Never seems to happen, but they got plenty of money for that.
Last I looked, we were 49th in job creation. We've done all that we could for the business, but the business haven't reciprocated in the favor. I'm in a very cold zone up here in the north, and we get clobbered with this seasonal unemployment bill that they're monkeying around with. Our work periods aren't as long as other parts of the state. We've got a ton of snow and cold weather. And this year, unemployment started in November for most of the outdoor workers. And with this new bill that they have, we'll get clobbered up here. It's the number one call in the city.
Yeah, you know, and looking at the coming year, what do you think the big issues are going to be? I've got my speculation. I'm curious what you're hearing in your circles.
Well, from what I'm hearing just this afternoon, talking to some of my colleagues from around the state, that the pension issue they're going to try and do, right to work, believe it or not, and some of these, a few of these reporters that want to dictate the schedule are pushing the liquor issue again. And the right to work, I think, is on the agenda of some of these people from the middle of the state. And I think that they feel like they're going to pressure these right-wing young zealots that got in there. They're going to tell them that they're going to run somebody against them in the primary if they don't perform or come through with these kind of things. Luckily, we still have sensible people on the other side of the aisle that will stand up or hopefully stand up and tell them that this is the way to go.
Yeah, it just seems it seems that a horrible waste of time, in my view. I mean, you go down the list of the things that the priorities that they've chosen. I mean, you know, there's a piece of legislation banging around that would make it illegal for local municipalities to pass paid sick day ordinances. You know, there's all of this stuff ancillary from what we should be doing. To me, create jobs. We need to be focused on jobs, education, investing in our future instead of all of this partisan bickering and this political payback, which to me, that's what right to work is. That's what the assault on the public sector workers are. That's what a lot of this stuff, it's political payback. It's Machiavellian, Chris Christie type payback.
The last 4 years has just been a waste of time, basically. The Corbett administration, they dropped the ball on so many. Start with the Penn State issue. You know, you go back to the governor and his days as the attorney general. He didn't perform very respectably there, in my opinion. And then he started first thing with the education cuts. Now they're trying to say that there weren't any cuts, it was federal dollars. Call it what it is. It was a cut, and it was a damage to the education system in Pennsylvania. They should be ashamed for what they did with that. The shale tax, that was another thing from the start. All of the money there. Beholden to the big money people that gave him campaign funds. Help to the city. He's got this thing called a CRIS, Community City Reinvestment and Revitalization Improvement Zone. He's pitting cities against cities to compete for tax dollars, to reinvigorate your downtown area. He should be out like Rendell was. I didn't always agree with Rendell, but reinvest in all the communities around the state. Like you said, put people back to work. I think they'll do away with a lot of the social problems and a lot of the other things that we're dealing with police agencies, hospitals, and everything else, if you get people back to work off the street.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely amazing that this governor is even running for re-election, given the approval numbers. And, you know, because I meet Republicans every day who go, I voted for that, you know what, I'll never do that again.
And I hear the same thing.
And look, I mean, you know, the hope is that we stop some of this insanity. You get some fresh blood. You get somebody else to say, look, all of this Koch brothers stuff, all of the stuff that Alec wants, all of these right wing dream pieces of legislation that are out there. Enough of this. Let's get back to doing the business of the Commonwealth. Get back to helping people instead of using our government as a tool to enrich the few. We need to help out the many.
And somebody that's a leader that can organize a team. Some of these department heads on New Year's Eve. I was on the phone, and then on New Year's Day over the WIC program in my area, and we had one of the higher poverty rates in the state. And this happened in August, and me and Senator Wiley up there solved it then. But they weren't paid their money, and now we're finding out that somebody may have had it in for somebody up at the Erie office, and they held up their checks intentionally, which penalized the people that needed this program vitally with young kids and everything else. And it's sickening. Can't get anybody. I hear names and I see people's names on things, but I've never met them, and when I call, I never get them. It's a frustrating way to operate a business or a government. When I was at UPS, we never would operate like this. They took their shots over the holiday, but I thought, boy, if people knew what was going on with their government and they were scrutinized like UPS was, you know, I think the heads would roll. But I want a leader that's going to have a team assembled that's going to work for the public, and we don't have that right now.
Yeah, and maybe that only comes with getting rid of this governor, and maybe a bunch of the extreme fringe part of the Republican Party. I mean, they're really what's blocked most anything going forward, and why it took so long to get even the meager transportation bill that we did get.
And there again, there's no leadership, there's no unity, there's no working with the legislature, be it the House or the Senate. I've never really met the governor. Most of my colleagues haven't either. But to go back to what I said before, with this coming election, I don't care if it's Democrat or Republican. I want to know who the best candidate is. And I'm impartial right now, but I want to know who the best candidate is and who are some of the people they would bring with them. I'm always curious on things like that. Tell me who you run with, and I'll tell you who you are, what I always live by.
Yeah, you know, and, man, you know, I look at the last 4 years, and I look at the lost opportunities at every juncture. I look at the decisions that were made, the priorities that were taken, and I just think that, you know, the working people of this Commonwealth have been getting it stuck to them for so long. Change is a must. It's just that simple.
Historically, when you look through the state and analyze who was a good governor, who wasn't, they were good on both sides of the aisle. And they were bad on good sides of the aisle, but you look back to a Milton Schaff, and you can say, hey, roads were bad, and they you know, the Thornburg administration came along and they corrected some things, and mental institutions took their hits under certain people, and other people came along and they changed things. Whoever gets in the next time is going to have a yeoman's job ahead of them, just to build the rapport again with the representatives, with the senators, the House members. And just to get confidence back into the voters. I mean, you see where this guy's numbers are at. Like you said, I had a guy today who was a Republican who distributed money to this guy from up in my area, and he said, boy, what a waste of time and money I did 4 years ago. He said, I helped this guy out because he promised me some things that he would change in government. He said, I didn't see any change for the better, much more for the worse.
Yeah, you know, and, you know, I look at this, and again, the priorities. You know, like you, I've heard that this no rights at work agenda is right here, pushing the attacks on the public workers, and this right to work. It really, and when you talk to people, is there any appetite for this? Because, you know, most of the things that we've spent a lot of time on, the liquor privatization, the lottery privatization, this right to work for less stuff, I've yet to have anyone say, boy, you know, the state would be really much better if we had these things. Do you hear anybody calling for this? Any of your constituents?
None of these things this governor proposed has any bearing with anybody in my area. Right to work is a joke. Like I said, I was a Teamster for 25 years, proud Teamster member. Worked hard as a UPS driver, and I got to know a lot of people in shops, blue collar, white collar workers. Everybody, I think, around here pretty much sees it for what it is. And when you research and you look into it, you find out it's the Koch brothers things like that that are pushing it. But, yeah, and I think even Corbett knows on that, that it's not going to go anywhere, and he knows it's a losing issue. So in some ways, I think, you know, with the budget being what it's going to be, he knows he can't be that divisive with something like that. The last thing he needs, 9, 10 months off from the election, is another Wisconsin.
No.
National news media beat the drum in the Capitol. I'd prepare with a sleeping bag to stay overnight a few nights on that one. But, yeah, you talk about the lottery issue, though. Look at the time and the money that was wasted for a year and a half over that.
Millions of dollars.
Millions of dollars. Who knows what promises were made there, just like the gas industry debacle. You know, he went into that without consulting with anybody, without discussing that. None of his higher-ups discussed that with anybody that I know of. And they tried to ram it through like everything else, and it came back to bite them.
Well, at least good for that. It's just, you know, I'm looking forward to the coming year, and I'm looking forward to stopping this stuff. And come November, somebody different, different priorities, a different direction, maybe a new, fresh direction to get things turned around. And I think we can be better than 49th in the country in job creation, don't you?
Much better. There's so many potential openings when you see electronics companies coming back, the healthcare field. And there's an issue with healthcare that it seems at every turn there's an issue with healthcare that can be solved. But that's one of the leading areas of employment up here for me.
Yeah.
And I just think that they're, and going back to education, that's the fundamental building block in my opinion. And I hope that the next governor will have the sense to put us on the right track with that and keep us where we needed to be 2 years ago, where this guy's taking us backwards.
I'm right with you. Pat, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us. Best of luck in this session, and please keep up the fight.
Likewise, and I'll keep you informed as things develop.
Please do. I appreciate it. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Beat up cars with the tires and rubbers go.
Blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm John Kerr. After new emails and texts were released on Wednesday linking New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's administration to the bridge closure scandal, Fox News devoted less than 15 minutes to the story that day, compared to more than 2 hours each on CNN and MSNBC. CNN's New Day highlighted the discrepancy with CNN's senior media correspondent Brian Stelter.
There were so many fewer mentions of the story on Fox that it got people wondering what was going on. With 2016 on the horizon, Fox News is an important place for Republicans or for conservatives to hear about these candidates. And if they don't hear a lot about this scandal, they may not take it as serious.
On his radio show, Rush Limbaugh seemed to confirm these suspicions.
The media, with the exception of Fox, which is probably safe to say in the Christie camp, the media is salivating now at the prospect that Christie's career is over.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Have you had your daily minimum requirement of triclosan today? How about your dosage of triclocarban? Chances are you have, but don't know it. These two are antimicrobial chemicals, which might sound like a good thing, except that they disrupt the human body's normal regulatory processes. Animal studies show, for example, that these triclos can be linked to the scrambling of hormones in children, disruption of puberty and of the reproductive system, decreases in thyroid hormone levels that affect brain development, and other serious health problems. Yet corporations have slipped them into all sorts of consumer products, pushing them with a blitz of advertising that claim the antibacterial ingredients prevent the spread of infections. The two chemicals were originally meant for use by surgeons to cleanse their hands before operations. But that tiny application has now proliferated like a plague, constantly exposing practically everyone to small amounts here, there, and everywhere, adding up to dangerous megadoses. Triclosan and triclocarban were first mixed into soaps, But then, boom, brand name corporations went wild, putting these hormone disruptors into about 2,000 products, including toothpaste, mouthwashes, fabrics, and, most astonishingly, even into baby pacifiers. Today, use of the chemicals is so prevalent that they can be found in the urine of 3/4 of Americans. They also accumulate in groundwater and soil, so they saturate our environment and eventually ourselves. One study found them in the breast milk of 97% of women tested. This is Jim Hightower saying, for decades, corporate lobbying and regulatory meekness let this chemical menace spread. But now, the Food and Drug Administration is finally questioning the continued use of the two triclos. For more information and action, go to the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC.org. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Oh, one lie leads to another two lies, covers the other three lies. Now you're in an awful fix. Four lies, you're getting in deeper. Five lies, piling up steeper. Get wise, or you're going to be telling six.
Well, you know, they've got a number of responses here. People think that Chris Christie's lying, and one person said that it's going to come out. They're going to find the smoking email. I hope so. I'm not against it. I love when people come out and say, I knew nothing about it. And then you find out, well, they did. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. You know, I've been hearing an awful lot here about how much the Republicans care. There's two factions of the Republican Party. There's the ones who really, they want to just say, you're a bunch of lazy bums, I want you to die in the street. And then there's the other side that's saying, oh, we care, because they're trying to court those voters. Oh, we care about your, about poverty, we care about somewhat of inequality. There's only one problem with that. And for those who say that, they really care, there's a problem with that. They don't have any policy initiatives. There's nothing that they're talking about that would help alleviate poverty. I mean, you can go back and you look at the war on poverty that Johnson put forth and say, okay, there were some very solid initiatives that you can argue were good, bad, and whatever, but they were policy moves forward. You could argue that education helps people get better jobs because they have more income and better training. You could argue that the investment in that is a good thing, and I do. So Medicare, you could make the argument that, by having Medicare, we have a healthier, older population who, may be more productive or just happier citizens, which is a good step forward. But we're not seeing those kind of policy initiatives from Republicans. Nothing. Their position has been, and look, if the moniker fits, you gotta wear it. They're the party of no. We're not going to do anything. No, we're not going to extend unemployment. No, we're not going to invest in infrastructure. No, we're not going to invest in health care. No, we're not going to raise the minimum wage. No, we're not going to do any number of the things that most economists say would get our economy moving. They were against the stimulus. They were against health care. They were against all of these things that could have moved us forward. But they want us to believe that they care about health, but they care about the poor, because it's their religious duty, right? And you could, because all we get for them, all they come up with is, if we give more tax cuts to corporations and we give more tax cuts to the wealthy, that's going to create jobs. That's their policy in good times. That's their policy in bad times. And it doesn't work. It doesn't really work in either time, to be honest. Now, look, we've got a couple of problems here in the U.S. The first one is that we've got a surplus of people who are looking for jobs. And by having more people than there are jobs, obviously the wages will stagnate and decline. The only way that you get wages really to rise are a couple of ways. You heavily organize, you heavily unionize, you have 30, 40, 50% union density so that it's raising everybody up because they're demanding higher wages for their work. or you have everybody in the workforce, which is tightening the labor pool, and then companies have to actually compete for people instead of being nitpicky and choosy. Instead of having five applicants or four or three or whatever it is now for every one job, they got one person. So the wages had better be pretty good so they can maybe attract someone from somewhere else, and that helps raise wages as well. That's not going to happen under Republican rule for a couple of reasons. One, they keep demanding that we keep pushing people into the labor force, especially families. I love the family value argument. We believe family values, but there's no policies to keep families at home. It's one of those interesting things. But the other part of this is when you have this surplus in labor, what you have is, you know, less ability to gain the wealth that you're creating. The other part of this is, so on the one hand, you've got this surplus of labor part. There are too many people who are unemployed. And the other part is the lack of wages. So in my view, a couple of things have to happen. We've got to prop up the lower end of the spectrum to get business moving so that you have this spiraling upward. And we've talked about this a number of times. We're a consumer-based economy. By taking the unemployment money out of the economy, you're slowing the economy. You're pulling money out. You're going to end up costing jobs. You're going to make unemployment worse. And I look at this, and it takes me back to their policies. Republicans need to, just as a matter of politics, come up with something that's going to make things better, not worse. Cutting taxes and cutting regulations make things worse in a situation like we're in. So then you've got them, okay, well, we're going to make unemployment worse by taking money out of the economy. We're going to make money worse by concentrating wealth at the top where they're not spending that resource and they're not spending it here. And then we're going to cut the programs that do work, the food stamps, the unemployment, and those type of things. And not going to expand Medicaid. Things that could get the economy moving and get money into consumers' pockets and get them spending again. And maybe the other part of it is increase consumer confidence. The things that could help, Republicans seem to be dead set against. Basically promoting full employment. The deficit spending, getting people back to work by saying, okay, well, you know, very Keynesian idea. Saying we're going to borrow some money to invest in our roads and our bridges and our broadband access and who knows what. Let's go back to the moon or something. Build something huge, whatever. But get people back to work. This way you start the ball rolling. It's like anything. You get the ball up over the top of the hill and down the other side. It's going to start rolling to pick up steam, right? Pretty simple. Now, Republicans, again, they think that if we just get government out of the way, we just get government off our back, and it cut taxes and cut spending and gut regulation, everything will be wonderful. And it's just not the reality. So what we're seeing right before our eyes is a Republican Party that's not talking about policy. They're talking about messaging. That's it. What all of the Republicans have in common is there's nothing policy-wise there. There are no new ideas. There's just no. And really the only guy in the Republican Party who's talking about anything that might be reasonable is Mike Lee, who I generally think is insane. But he has an expansion of the child tax credit, which I guess I can understand from his religious view, especially in Utah, go forth, be fruitful, have 100 kids, and give, you know, huge tax breaks for that. That on a level could help. But he's got it muddled with a whole bunch of other, give businesses a whole bunch of money and give the wealthy all they want and that it's never going to pass either party. So at the end of it, there's nothing. And when we come back, I want to talk about, you know, what does create jobs? You know, I got an email here I want to go over that, you know, someone points out that, you know what, unions do create jobs. And when we come back, we'll talk about that. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Interested in your thoughts, comments, questions, right back. Stick around.
Why's the rich man busy dancing while the poor man pays?
in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
January of 1964 was a time to remember for many Americans. The Beatles released their first album. New York announced plans to build a World Trade Center. The Surgeon General announced smoking kills, and President Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty during his first State of the Union address. January 1964 was also a momentous year for the American truck drivers. The nation's truckers saw the first nationwide labor contract. The National Master Freight Agreement, covering some 450,000 truck drivers employed by 16,000 companies across the country, set a nationwide minimum wage of $3.33 per hour, or $23.63 in 2008 dollars, as well as providing health care and retirement benefits for all its members. The 1964 National Master Freight Agreement set a nationwide standard for working conditions, giving drivers a voice in the job and the power to stand up to abusive treatment, and eventually the ability to refuse to drive equipment the driver deemed unsafe. Led by labor visionary James R. Hoffa, this victory was the crowning achievement of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters as one of America's most influential unions. This landmark agreement created a framework for all national contracts to follow. Jimmy Hoffa, the man who famously quipped, "I may have many faults, being wrong is not one of them," was certainly right about the benefits, power, and influence of such a national agreement for workers, both union and non-union. Wages and benefits earned by truck drivers brought millions of hardworking men and women solidly into the middle class by rewarding hard work with a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. For generations, the National Master Freight Agreement served as the industry standard for all truck drivers, raising wages, improving benefits, and providing a safer workplace for drivers and the motoring public. Unfortunately, since the 1980 passage of trucking deregulation, the industry has resorted to cutthroat competition based on who is willing to work for less. In this environment, the National Master Freight Agreement has lost some of its power in lifting truck drivers out of low wage, no benefit, and hazardous conditions. Currently, many non-union truck drivers are earning at or near poverty wages while pushing legal limits. For many truckers, their pay is solely determined by the number of miles they drive. Breakdowns, time spent waiting to be loaded and unloaded, and other delays are shouldered by the driver, in most cases without compensation. 1964 and the years that follow has shown what can be accomplished by workers standing together. Perhaps the future will see resurgence in worker solidarity and the reemergence of a fair day's work, a fair day's pay. This Rick Smith Show, Labor History Moment, is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
And you know, the sandwich comes in, you touch this, touch this, touch this, go pay the cashier, there's your sandwich. It's amazing.
Oh, ho, ho, it's magic.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So Andy, one of our podcasters, points out that sent me an email about a caller I had back, you know, last month. He guy called in and said, unions don't create jobs. Well, Andy took exception to that. He said unions do create jobs because these admirable citizens spend money. They consume goods and services. Andy writes, this bolsters the GDP, creates demand, so creates jobs. They are the number one factor creating jobs, since 70% of our GDP is citizens' buying power. And he writes, the more money union members and working people have to spend, the better our economy will do, lifting up the lives of everyone. And he points out, unions and working people with more purchasing power lift all boats in our economy. And he then goes on to say that the CEOs and corporations don't create jobs. Pointed at the caller, he said it's the unions and the working people spending their money that creates jobs, creating demand, which justifies hiring. He says we get a nice multiplier of hiring. And the more hiring begets more hiring. And, you know, he's spot on. The more money you put into the hands of average, everyday working people to spend money to support their families and to buy homes and to furnish those homes and buy the refrigerators and washers and dryers and clothes for the kids and all of that stuff, that's how the economy moves along. Handing huge amounts of money to the very top of the economic scale, not so much. And I can tell you what doesn't create jobs. Bloomberg News had a story today that looked at executive compensation, and they pointed out that in a number of different industry sectors, the top five executives for 2012, for instance, the energy sector, the top five CEOs made an average of $23.2 million. In the consumer staples sector, made about $22.3 million. In consumer discretionary sector, about $22.2. Healthcare and pharmaceutical, $20.6. And you get the idea. All of these different sectors, the CEOs are making $20-plus million a year for the average of the top five. And this has grown every year, every single year since 2007. It has gone up exponentially. Now, I don't know that you can say that for the average everyday worker. And there's the argument, and it makes a little bit of sense to some people who go, well, there's a meritocracy. The better you do, the better you get paid, right? Wrong. Because I know people who are working their butts off, working 40, 50, 60 hours a week, and they're worse off than they were 2-3 years ago. The CEOs, always better off. So what Bloomberg News did is they said, okay, we're going to go through these different sectors where you've got these CEOs who are making $23.2 million and say, okay, how did their shareholders do? Now, understand, I'm not someone who gives a whole lot of takers damn about the shareholders. I care about the workers. But if you're going to use that matrix, if the CEO's pay is based on shareholder value, because that's what the CEO's job is. His job is to maximize shareholder wealth. The president of the company is to run the business, which I always thought it was amazing that you could have a CEO and a president be the same guy, because I do believe there are conflicting roles. One, on the one side, the CEO only cares about the shareholder. We got to make sure the shareholders are happy. So we're going to pump the stock up as high as we can, and if that means screwing the operation, that's what it means. Now, the president's job is to make sure the operation runs efficiently and things get done. Seems kind of a conflicting role. Maybe just my opinion on that. But they went through, Bloomberg went through, and they looked at the Russell 1000 industry sector. They looked at the median compensation. For instance, the technology sector. Compensation rose by 47%. Shareholder wealth, only 35%. So can you make an argument that, well, they did so much better that they deserve that? No. And in fact, what they came across is since 2007, only healthcare, consumer discretionary, and technology had executives where their shareholder value went up higher than their wages. The financial services, the durables, utilities, energy, a whole bunch of other stuff, the other side. In fact, you know, some of the things you go, wow, you got a raise so much higher. The financial services, for instance, financial services since 2007, compensation to the CEOs of the top five companies went up 28% over that time period. Shareholder value, a negative 44%. And you go, how in the world can you possibly, with a straight face, say, I deserve 20-some million dollars a year? In the utilities sector, compensation for the top five executives up 33%. Shareholder value only 4%. Yet I don't hear the shareholders screaming loud enough. Why? Because they're taken care of as well. And it's generally the same people, because you've got the top 1% who owns 35% of this entire country and about 80% of all stocks. They control all of this stuff, man. Now, me, I'm telling you, I'm back to the idea of, if we're not talking about a maximum wage, if we're not saying that the CEO compensation is way the heck out of hand, I'm saying we need a tax rate that's going to minimize some of that. Or we need an organized, militant workforce of active, engaged, informed citizen workers who are going to say, enough of this. Ridiculous. Explain to me how it is that by giving all of this wealth to these handful of people, and we're talking enormous amounts of wealth going to these CEOs, that they can't possibly spend on consumer goods. Because understand, going back to the original premise, that our economy runs on consumer spending. The more money that Jack and Jane and Rick and everybody else has in their pocket, the more money they spend in the local stores, the local restaurants, the more they get their car fixed, the more they get their roof fixed, additions on the house, whatever. That's what drives the economy. When in the Smith household, we bought new cabinets for the kitchen. I ripped everything out, put the new ones in. When we put the hardwood floors in, that stimulates the economy. Because people had to make that stuff, and we had a couple installers come in and do the hardwood floors since my wife wouldn't let me anywhere near it. And I don't blame her. I wouldn't have let me near it either, because I don't like being on my knees that long, and I'm sure I would have rushed through it. But what I'm saying is somebody has to do these jobs, and it's good for the economy. And you can only do that when you've got a little bit of money in your pocket. When you're concentrating all the wealth at the very top into the CEO suites and into these huge investors, and these institutional investors, there's a problem in my view. And I think at some point we've got to say enough's enough already. Especially when you look at some of the wage structures and you look at the things that are going on. You look at the money that's being concentrated and hoarded. You know, you look at this and these big companies are sitting on trillions of dollars. Trillions. And we're told that they're going to invest it. They're going to create jobs, but they're uncertain. The taxes might go up. What we should have been doing is we should have been taxing them all along. And we should have been saying, we'll give you demand because we need stuff to get done. And that, I believe, would have moved the economy forward. Going to take a quick break. If you missed any portion of the program, the RickSmithShow.com. That's where you get the podcast. Stitcher on your smartphone. Back with Hour 2. Stick around.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to the Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. On the 50th anniversary of President Lyndon B. Johnson's war on poverty, the U.S. Senate is closer to extending unemployment benefits for another 3 months for long-term jobless workers. A few Republicans have joined the Democrats to vote to advance the legislation. Republicans, though, are trying to get more budget cuts in return for extending the benefits. President Obama is urging Congress to extend the jobless benefits. The official poverty rate was 19% during the Johnson administration, and it's 15% now. Right-wing conservatives fought the anti-poverty programs then and continue to oppose them now, but even with the opposition that limited the effectiveness of the war on poverty, tens of millions of people have still been lifted out of poverty. According to the Census Bureau, anti-poverty programs kept 41 million Americans out of poverty in 2012. These programs include food assistance, unemployment compensation, Social Security, and earned income tax credits.
About 1,200 French workers are losing their jobs at a Goodyear plant, and they're not happy with the severance pay. They held two managers captive for a few hours, threatening to detain them until the company agreed to pay out big severance amounts to the workers. The unions representing the workers want the equivalent of $110,000 in severance pay, plus about $3,400 per each year worked. French police freed the managers, but the French government doesn't severely prosecute these manager abductions, seeing them as acts of desperation and not as serious felony crimes of kidnapping as they would be treated in the U.S. After the managers were freed, workers continued their protests at the plant, including burning about 100,000 euros worth of Goodyear tires. When a plant closes in France, the entire international operation of the owner of the plant is taken into account when it comes to how the closing is handled. French workers have used the capture the boss and hold them tactic several times over the years as one of many tactics to win better compensation or working conditions. The Workers' Organizing Committee of Chicago helped Snarf sandwich shop workers protest what they say are unfair terminations of workers. The rally Wednesday at 2 Prudential Plaza in Chicago demanded the reinstatement of the fired workers and furlough payments. All of the workers at the Snarfs at 600 West Chicago were fired December 22nd. They were fired by email without notice just 3 days before Christmas. The St. Louis Show Me 15 campaign staged a protest in solidarity with the Chicago action and with the fired Chicago Snarf workers on Wednesday. Snarf is a national sandwich shop chain. The workers have filed NLRB complaints. Hundreds of supporters have called on Snarf to reinstate the workers.
This is a very sad day for 100,000 workers who are wondering what their future will hold.
We cannot afford to lose this fight. This is the end of everything that we built over 75 years.
Say if a machine breaks down, they would actually take gray tape it up.
Listener support is vital to keep these worker voices on the radio news airwaves. Support Workers Independent News now by donating at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee in a right-to-work state at a low cost with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? It's time to let these people learn the lesson the hard way.
Yeah, you hear it. I mean, there's a congressman, a sitting U.S. congressman saying, yeah, you know what, you workers, less wages for you, less health care, less benefits, less security, less of a voice. That's your future. That's the future, Pennsylvania. We're going to be the Tennessee, where Zach Womp's from, or the Mississippi or the South Carolina with low wages, no health care. This is where we're heading. This is where the Republican majority in our state seems to want to take us, because I'm hearing the whispers that right to work for free is coming. Here to help work through some of that is our good friend, attorney Erwin Aronson. Erwin, thanks for taking time for me.
Good to be here, Rick. How are you?
I'm not pleased. There are so many things that we should be doing. There are so many priorities as a state we should be moving towards. This, a massive distraction, a massive destruction of workers' ability to feed their families in this state. I am just fit to be tied.
Well, you should be fit to be tied. Everybody should be fit to be tied. And it's rare that I disagree with you, but I don't call this a massive distraction. I call this a massive deception. With so many real and meaningful problems facing working men and women in Pennsylvania, facing unemployed people in Pennsylvania, facing students, facing our seniors, facing people who are sick, facing people who are living in nursing homes, facing people who are really having to make difficult choices, why anybody in the General Assembly would agree, acquiesce in the idea of even considering this poison, this venom, all just speaks to the sad reality of our time. The sad reality of our time is simply that these people are interested in trying to find a way to buy our government from out from under us and steal our freedom to eat, our freedom to feed our children, our freedom to access decent schools for no reason. There's this wonderful editorial that appeared just in the last couple of days in the Salem, Oregon newspaper that calls it for what it is. Points out that it's deception to call this right to work. It doesn't confer any rights on anybody. They should call it, according to the Salem, Oregon newspaper, right to destroy unions, right to take away people's rights. At least that then the players would be honest. But there's no honesty in this. There's no integrity in this. These people lack the courage to even say what they really need to do.
Yeah.
They have to do it through deception.
You know, I look at this, and, you know, last night we talked with Wendell Young, the president of UFCW Local 1776, about this this scheme that I hear banging around. I understand Cutler, Representative Cutler, has a piece of legislation, 1507, that would, and I'm still trying to get my head around it, what the point behind all of this is. Because I guess the claim is that it's so expensive for the state to collect dues that were negotiated by the workers, it's so expensive that it's just the state can't do it anymore, and they're going to make it illegal to have the workers in the state negotiate for this because it's so incredibly expensive, yet they'll continue to do all of the other deductions. I'm struggling with this.
Well, you should be struggling with this. This is so insignificant that the state and other public employers that for years have had the right to ask unions, once the employers have agreed freely with the union to have dues deductions, they've always had the right to charge the union for the alleged cost of this, and they never have because they can't even identify it. This is just one more thing that's programmed into the computer. It doesn't cost anything. It doesn't cost anything whatsoever. But if it did have a cost, and the cost could be identified, they could charge for it. That's not the point. The point is that this representative who's carrying the water for ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, carrying the water for the Koch brothers, carrying the water for the people who are hell-bent for leather on destroying the American way of life, is saying, once again, through a lack of courage, through fundamental deception, that the reason for this has to do with how much it costs taxpayers to collect and transmit to. That's not it at all. What it has to do with is stripping people of their rights. And it has to do with stripping people of their rights in the most obnoxious, fundamentally offensive way, the way that is based on telling a lie because they can't face the truth themselves. That's it. That's all. Nothing more.
Yeah,
they're liars.
Yeah, and
lying liars, and that's the way it is.
But you look at where all this seems to be coming from, and you pointed out the American Legislative Exchange Council and the huge money funders, the Koch brother types, who the Wall Street types, these billionaires who fund these things. And I keep asking the question, let's say we pass it. Who benefits from it? Do the workers, do the taxpayers, who benefits from it?
Well, you know, it's hard to identify who in our society that needs a benefit would benefit from it. The fact of the matter is, right to work doesn't give anybody any rights or any work. It takes away rights. And it has the government stepping in and interfering as the government with the right to freely contract between two willing parties. That's the craziest piece of all. These people who say they want to get government off our back are trying to get government off our back by putting it right in our pockets.
And in our bedrooms and everywhere else.
In our bedrooms and everywhere else. You're absolutely right. The fact remains that what we have in a nutshell, because of a case called Citizens United that took away the limitations and restrictions on spending political money and outblown, overgrown wealth in the hands, concentrated in the hands of a very few, that have too much money and they can throw it around and spend it in fashions that screw people just for the sake of screwing people.
So since you brought that up, that's an interesting point because, you know, one of the knocks that, one of the reasons that I've heard, and I've only heard it whispered to me, the reason that the Brian Cutlers of the world and the Koch brothers want to really stick it to workers and their unions is because, well, they spend all this money on politics, which, I don't know, the last time I checked, unions are spent, what, like 15, 20 to 1? By the manufacturing association and those ilk. Doesn't this just appear to be what it is? A way to silence workers' voices and make sure that there's no money for the opposition to steamroller over them?
That's absolutely correct. You know, they keep on telling us how irrelevant unions are. If unions were this irrelevant, why are they spending so much money to destroy them?
So much taxpayer money.
These are people that are getting subsidies. Remember, It cost the government of the United States about $6 billion to provide unemployment insurance for 3 months. And it cost our same United States government $10.2 billion just to continue offshore specialized tax credits for big business alone. So we know who they are. These are people just that have too much money. What we really ought to be doing in response to this is talking about a maximum wage campaign.
Yep.
A maximum wage campaign that says once you get a certain amount of money in the course of 1 year, we're going to take the rest away from you so you don't have the money in your pocket that is used to do this violence to people.
Yeah, you must have been listening to the program earlier because I exactly what I just said. I say we go back to the good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower's tax code. Bring that back.
Yeah, that would be a good start. You know, that terrible socialist, you pointed it out, Dwight David Eisenhower. Dwight David Eisenhower, you know, the socialist who said we'll use taxpayer money to build a highway system to subsidize the trucking industry and subsidize interstate commerce. That's socialism. On the other hand, now that we have that highway system, what we're supposed to do is turn it over to big business, lock, stock, and barrel, let them toll it,
yep.
Charge us to go on the roads we paid for.
So we can have Chris Christie's government in New Jersey shut down the lanes and cause backups for 6-7 hours.
Not just cause backup for 6-7 hours. Cause people who are stuck in ambulances fighting for life to not get to hospital.
Yes.
Let's talk about this as what it is.
Absolutely.
Okay. There comes a time when people need to be able to stand up and say, enough, we're entitled to hear the truth. Whether it's on this phony right to work baloney that doesn't give anybody who works for a living any rights whatsoever, and the people who sponsor it have to hide behind a phony slogan in order to sell their voices, or the likes of Chris Christie, a damn street bully who is using the power of his high office, the power that comes from his raising his right hand and swearing to uphold, protect, and defend the laws of the state of New Jersey, using them or acquiescing in his staff, using them purely to punish people who did support his reelection in an open and public way. And what's the result of that? People died, Rick.
Yep, yep.
People died just so that they could make their political point that they didn't like the fact that the Democratic mayor of Fort Lee, New Jersey, didn't come out publicly and endorse Chris Christie in his reelection campaign.
It's insane, isn't it? And the other thing I wanted to ask you about, Erwin, you know, with yesterday being the 50th anniversary of Johnson's war on poverty, you know, we've been hearing a lot of voices, you know, oh, it's a failure, it's an abysmal failure. It's like we just threw all this money down a big hole and nobody benefited from it. I wanted to get your thoughts on the last 50 years, and because I've taken the position it was a success, and I look at the mirror when I see myself as someone who benefited from a number of those programs in education and food stamps and things that got me to the point where I am now. I see it as a success, and I know there are millions of other people who see it as well. I'm curious your thoughts.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. As you know, our childhoods were rather similar, and the war on poverty is now the subject of a war itself. They're making a war on the war on poverty. And the war on poverty has sadly been far too successful, and these programs are being dismantled. Just in the last month, we have them dismantling unemployment insurance. A couple of months earlier, not even a couple of months earlier, stripping people of food stamps. And who does it hurt? Well, you know, it hurts the people who are the beneficiaries or used to be of these programs in a very direct way. But it also hurts the businesses that were accruing that income. Understand, unemployment insurance is spent. Every single dollar that somebody gets in unemployment insurance, every single dollar's worth of food stamps that somebody gets is spent. It's not like the money that's hoarded by the Koch brothers so that they can unleash it from time to time to pursue their right to work point. It's money that's spent on sugar and shoes, on medicine, on milk, on rent, on telephone bills, on heat, on light, on making their way through a grocery store. And that money keeps our communities running. It keeps our communities going. This is not just a war on poverty. It's a war on the undermining of our economy that happens when you create an institutionalized a country that has only two classes, the multi-rich and the multitude. So I couldn't agree with you more. The notion that the war on poverty is a failure is only believed by the people who are making war on the people who are in poverty.
Yep. And I look at my grandmother, who back before 50 years ago would have been solidly one of those 60-65% of senior women who were in poverty. And today she's just above the, she's not living the high life, but she's just above poverty and she's stable. And that is a direct link, a direct benefit of that. And I don't know how you can say that, that it has any, that's anything close to a failure.
Well, it's, you know, the only failure about the war on poverty that Lyndon Johnson announced in his State of the Union message 50 years ago and that was pursued so well is that we haven't continued to pursue it.
Right.
We've,
and we've
slashed
allowed
funding as a nation for public housing. We have slashed food stamps. We have slashed access to medical care, even as they tell us how terrible what they refer to as Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is. We keep slashing funding for this here in Pennsylvania. Governor Corbett won't even accept, with the appropriate conditions, money available to provide health care for the poor. If ever there was a fundamental to the war on poverty, it's assuring that people have access to medical care. And the alternative to people having access to medical care, of course, is even more expensive.
Yeah, and the other part of it that I think he left out is giving people like Corbett the opportunity to destroy our education system.
Well, yeah, there is that. Remember, if ever there was something fundamental, it's the recognition that children who live in poverty don't learn and don't get to learn, and that means they don't get out of poverty. But the key, the avenue, the ability to get out of poverty in this country has always been that one great equalizer, access to a quality education, a quality public education. And Governor Corbett, as you well know, we've talked about it on this show in the past, has, during his short three-plus years in the office of governor of Pennsylvania, slashed roughly $3 billion, that's billion with a B, from public education funding, even as he's expanded the dual or the parallel education system that they call charter schools that are saddling the taxpayers with the burden of paying for a fully private system while they still have to pay for the public system, and it's the public system that has been destroyed and decimated by corporate slashes and cuts. To get an idea of what $1 billion is, if we put $50 bills end to end around the globe, it would circumnavigate the globe five times.
Wow.
To get to the first billion.
Absolutely.
At the equator, at the widest spot.
Wow. I mean, that leaves you speechless almost. I mean, you think of that kind of disinvestment in the future of this country, and wow.
Disinvestment in the future of this country. Disinvestment in the people that he says are our most important resource, our children. All so he can assure that the multi-rich continue to get specialized tax breaks, continue to get welfare, corporate welfare, out of the state of Pennsylvania, so he can guarantee that his buddies in the Marcellus shale field can continue to strafe the land and not pay an extraction tax that these very same companies pay even in places like Texas and Alaska. You say you don't get it? Our listeners ought to be not just a little bit upset. They ought to be fundamentally damn angry because they are being victimized every day by this crowd who refuses deal with or acknowledge reality, who fails to realize that the only way they can continue to exist is through deception.
And then all of the poison we're going to see in the next couple of weeks, in the next month or two, is just going to highlight all that. And I'm sure you'll come back and keep us abreast of what's going on. It's always great having you on the program, Irwin.
Always great to be here, and I'll be honored. I hope to get a chance to be on the show again next week.
Absolutely. Our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Minor winds are blowing, it's kicking up the sand, it's blowing out a message to every woman, child, and man. blowing across the land and across the sea. It's blowing peace and freedom. It's blowing equality. Yes, it's blowing peace and freedom. It's blowing you and me.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm John Kerr. After new emails and texts were released on Wednesday linking New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's administration to the bridge closure scandal, Fox News devoted less than 15 minutes to the story that day, compared to more than 2 hours each on CNN and MSNBC. CNN's New Day highlighted the discrepancy with CNN's senior media correspondent Brian Stelter.
There were so many fewer mentions of the story on Fox that it got people wondering what was going on. With 2016 on the horizon, Fox News is an important place for Republicans or for conservatives to hear about these candidates. And if they don't hear a lot about this scandal, they may not take it as serious.
On his radio show, Rush Limbaugh seemed to confirm these suspicions.
The media, with the exception of Fox, which is probably, it's safe to say, in the Christie camp, the media is salivating now at the prospect that Christie's career is over.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Have you had your daily minimum requirement of triclosan today? How about your dosage of triclocarban? Chances are you have, but don't know it. These two are antimicrobial chemicals, which might sound like a good thing, except that they disrupt the human body's normal regulatory processes. Animal studies show, for example, that these triclos can be linked to the scrambling of hormones in children, disruption of puberty and of the reproductive system, decreases in thyroid hormone levels that affect brain development, and other serious health problems. Yet corporations have slipped them into all sorts of consumer products, pushing them with a blitz of advertising that claim the antibacterial ingredients prevent the spread of infections. The two chemicals were originally meant for use by surgeons to cleanse their hands before operations. But that tiny application has now proliferated like a plague, constantly exposing practically everyone to small amounts here, there, and everywhere, adding up to dangerous megadoses. Triclosan and triclocarban were first mixed into soaps. But then, boom, brand-name corporations went wild, putting these hormone disruptors into about 2,000 products, including toothpaste, mouthwashes, fabrics, and, most astonishingly, even into baby pacifiers. Today, use of the chemicals is so prevalent that they can be found in the urine of 3/4 of Americans. They also accumulate in groundwater and soil, so they saturate our environment and eventually ourselves. One study found them in the breast milk of 97% of women tested. This is Jim Hightower saying, for decades, corporate lobbying and regulatory meekness let this chemical menace spread. But now, the Food and Drug Administration is finally questioning the continued use of the two triclos. For more information and action, go to the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
In the factories and the fields, in the city streets and the quiet country towns.
Working together.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. I want to go back over this, this rhetoric, this nonsense that they call right to work. Because understand, the bottom line in this, and it sounds, I should have the right to work, which I would be in favor of the right to every person in this country to have a job, the right to get gainful employment, to be able to support your family. I'm right there. If that's what right to work means, if I have a right to a job, then I'm there. I'm the first one in line. I'm the first one to hold the sign. I'm the first one to call my legislator, cast the first vote. But this poison, this nonsense, this ridiculous notion that, oh, well, you have a right to work. What they're telling me is ridiculous. When you look at the facts, and these are the unmitigated facts, this is the reality. The states that have this designation, they make less money. And Zach Wapp, the congressman from Tennessee, said it in the opening thing we used last segment.
less wages, less benefits. That's reality. The reality is right at the work states, workers make about $1,500 less each and every year. Median household incomes in those states, $6,400 less. And you go down the list, you know, just basic health care coverage, considerably lower in right-to-work states. And then you get into the job stuff, higher rates of injury, higher rates of death, and you go, is this really what we want Pennsylvania to turn into? Higher rates of poverty, higher rates of infant mortality, less investment in education, although our governor is moving us toward that. When he talks well of places like South Carolina, that's where he wants to take us. The educational investment they have in places like that. And you go down the list and you see this stuff. Now, the poison that they're going to say is, hey, you know what? If Pennsylvania would be a right-to-work state, we could steal jobs from New Jersey. We could steal jobs from Maryland. We could steal jobs from New York or Ohio or even we could steal jobs from West Virginia. You know, like they've done in other places, like they did in Michigan. Oh, we can steal jobs from Indiana and all around there. That's their mentality. We can steal from others. These are the kind of backbiting, backstabbing type of people who would push this kind of poison. But here's reality. And EPI, the Economic Policy Institute, has done a bunch of studies on this. States that have done the right-to-work thing, there have been no signs of economic growth. In fact, they've actually seen things going the other way. They found out that there's no relationship between right-to-work laws and employers going there because employers don't really look for that much. What they're looking for, educated workforce. They're looking for infrastructure. And they're looking for location. They're not looking for this nonsensical right-to-work. And at the end of it, when you start looking at the cuts to wages that will be coming by reducing workers' ability to demand a better wage, to demand good conditions, to demand reasonable health care and some sense of retirement security, when you see that happening, what ends up happening is by cutting these wages, you undermine job growth. You make things worse. By taking money out of workers' pockets, you make the economy worse. You end up like South Carolina with extraordinarily high unemployment. And what EPI found is for every $1 million you see in wage cuts, you see an additional 6 jobs lost in the economy. So for every $1 million in wage cuts, so let's say, you know, a place they cut 1 million employees by $1 an hour, that's 6 jobs out of the economy. Because that money is what reverberated through the economy, kept people working. And then you look at Pennsylvania, it's got a pretty good-sized economy. If you start seeing our wages going backwards, you're going to see unemployment continue to creep up. And there's part of me that thinks the reason there's no appetite by the Republicans to pass the emergency unemployment extension is so that the unemployment rate goes down, because we kick those people off the rate. So off the radar, we don't see it. But what you need to take from this is this is a distraction. This is division and diversion away from what they should really be doing. There's no benefit here for working people. And I don't care if you're someone who's ever been part of a union or never going to be part of a union or know nothing about unions. The reality is when you take workers' ability to negotiate for better wages, hours, and conditions away, everybody is harmed by it. Everybody. Not just the union members. Because understand, you know, back when we had 35% union density, you had a massive middle class. You had a massive middle class of people who had similar wages. As that ability to negotiate and bring wages up has been destroyed, all of our wages have stagnated. And in fact, most of our wages have gone backwards. That's the poison that's going to kill the working class of this country. And we can't have it. And I'm actually looking forward to seeing who puts their name on the line so that we can go after them and say, look, voters, this is what these folks want for you. And you should be paying attention to. It's that simple. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit more about the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty and also the unemployment extensions. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
On the 50th anniversary of President Lyndon B. Johnson's war on poverty, the U.S. Senate is closer to extending unemployment benefits for another 3 months for long-term jobless workers. A few Republicans have joined the Democrats to vote to advance the legislation. Republicans, though, are trying to get more budget cuts in return for extending the benefits. President Obama is urging Congress to extend the jobless benefits. The official poverty rate was 19% during the Johnson administration, and it's 15% now. Right-wing conservatives fought the anti-poverty programs then and continue to oppose them now, but even with the opposition that limited the effectiveness of the war on poverty, tens of millions of people have still been lifted out of poverty. According to the Census Bureau, anti-poverty programs kept 41 million Americans out of poverty in 2012. These programs include food assistance, unemployment compensation, Social Security, and earned income tax credits. About 1,200 French workers are losing their jobs at a Goodyear plant, and they're not happy with the severance pay. They held two managers captive for a few hours, threatening to detain them until the company agreed to pay out big severance amounts to the workers. The unions representing the workers want the equivalent of $110,000 in severance pay, plus about $3,400 per each year worked. French police freed the managers, but the French government doesn't severely prosecute these manager abductions, seeing them as acts of desperation and not as serious felony crimes of kidnapping as they would be treated in the U.S. After the managers were freed, workers continued their protests at the plant, including burning about 100,000 euros worth of Goodyear tires. When a plant closes in France, the entire international operation of the owner of the plant is taken into account when it comes to how the closing is handled. French workers have used the capture the boss and hold them tactic several times over the years as one of many tactics to win better compensation or working conditions. The Workers' Organizing Committee of Chicago helped Snarf sandwich shop workers protest what they say are unfair terminations of workers. The rally Wednesday at 2 Prudential Plaza in Chicago demanded the reinstatement of the fired workers and furlough payments. All of the workers at the Snarfs at 600 West Chicago were fired December 22nd. They were fired by email without notice just 3 days before Christmas. The St. Louis Show Me 15 campaign staged a protest in solidarity with the Chicago action and with the fired Chicago Snarf workers on Wednesday. Snarf is a national sandwich shop chain. The workers have filed NLRB complaints. Hundreds of supporters have called on Snarf to reinstate the workers.
This is a very sad day for 100,000 workers who are wondering what their future will hold.
We cannot afford to lose this. This is the end of everything that we built over 75 years.
Say if a machine breaks down, they would actually take gray duct tape to tape it up.
Listener support is vital to keep these worker voices on the radio news airwaves. Support Workers Independent News now by donating at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. So last night I talked a little bit about this story from Texas that caught my attention. There's a restaurant owner in Texas who one of his employees, a 19-year-old girl, found out she had a little rash on her leg, went to the doctor, said, oh, you got a blood clot, and then they found a tumor. Turns out she doesn't have insurance, her parents don't have health insurance. Here's this girl, you know, with this horrible medical problem and no way to pay for it. The restaurant owner is actually put the restaurant up for sale to help pay this girl's medical bills. And I know, look, there are very few employers that are willing to do that, but I keep asking the question, why do they have to? Why can't we seem to make sure that every citizen in this country gets the health care that they need, and I will use the word deserve? Anyway, yesterday the House Democratic Policy Committee held a hearing, brought a number of people across the state and across the country in to talk about why this governor should be taking the Medicaid expansion. And I've asked Jim Wilshire, Director of Policy and Partnership at the Pennsylvania Association of Community Health Centers, their website, PACHC.com. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Jim's name. Jim, thanks for taking time for us.
No, thanks for inviting me, Rick, and giving me an opportunity to talk with your audience.
You know, I look at this, you know, this story from Texas that is just, on one hand, it's an amazing story of somebody who's willing to step forward, but I don't understand why businesses have to or why anyone would have to when in the richest country of the world, we should make sure that every person has access to good quality, affordable health care.
It's a horrible story. I'm glad that they found a condition that they can try to help treat for the poor person that got the diagnosis, then it's great that the employer is willing to try to help. The only good news I can give in that situation beyond the fact that they were able to diagnose it is that, like you said, I'm with the Pennsylvania Association of Community Health Centers, and community health centers are in every state across the country. We have a good number here in Pennsylvania, and they're open to everyone. So I'm not sure where she got treated, but the one good news is if anyone ever has a malady or they need to see a primary care doc, we're open to everyone, all the health centers across the country. So I don't have much good news to give on that instance, but at least someone were sick and they needed to see a doctor, we do have places that individuals can go to. And I'm glad to be able to be on the show to try to talk about a little bit about that, too.
Yeah, good, because I want to get to that. Now, yesterday you were called to testify in front of the policy committee. I think it was in Philadelphia, or I think it was. What did you testify to?
Yes. We did. I represented our association, our members in Philadelphia yesterday before the policy committee, like you said. And our purpose of being there was to talk a lot about what's going on with the Healthy Pennsylvania proposal, specifically to what Governor Corbett has proposed as a, more of a counter to Medicaid expansion of the Affordable Care Act. And as it is a counter proposal, it's actually what's called a 1115 waiver, and our association, our members have been talking with the Corbett administration, and what we try to tell them is we are glad to have a conversation and glad that Pennsylvania is talking about providing some form of insurance to individuals that are 133% federal poverty level or below. And what that really means is that these are working people that through no fault of their own, it may be too costly for an employer to provide insurance to them, or they may not be able to afford insurance on their own, and that includes the insurance that might be available on the insurance marketplace or the insurance exchanges that were created through the Affordable Care Act may be too expensive for them. And we just want to talk about what some of the impacts that proposal can have for our members, our community health centers specifically, because as great it is to have the conversation, there are some components of the plan as it is that are specific to community health centers. And if it were submitted or if it was pursued as it is, it would be very problematic for community health centers seeing these new patients because, like I said before, we're open to everyone. So we would be seeing, as we do now, we see every patient regardless of their ability to pay, regardless of their insurance status. But with some of the design of the Healthy Pennsylvania plan as it is, it would make it basically uncompensated care costs for some of the patients that would be coming in that would be exactly caught in the Healthy Pennsylvania plan as members that would be purchasing insurance through the Healthy Pennsylvania plan.
Now, any sense of how many people we're talking about if the governor doesn't take the Medicaid expansion and if his plan doesn't get approved at the federal level, which I seriously doubt it's going to be approved because some of the things he's asked for that's been turned down in other states. But how many people, any sense of a number ballpark?
The estimate that's given for the Healthy Pennsylvania plan is 500,000 individuals. 500,000 Pennsylvanians stand to be able to gain from this. If we're able to all work together to be able to craft something that can get federal approval.
That's a pretty sizable number of folks. And as you pointed out, these are working people.
Yes.
Because, you know, we hear a lot of demonization, and I don't know if you have, but I hear a lot of demonization. Oh, those people should just go out and get jobs. And I'm like, well, they do. They have jobs. Their employers just don't provide health insurance.
Yeah, and, I mean, there could be a lot of reasons for why the insurance isn't provided. Like I said, there might be some people where they're looking to buy it on the insurance marketplace, which is, you know, great if that was a decision that they wanted to make personally for, you know, whatever reasons that the employer isn't able to provide it anymore. But sometimes even with some of the subsidies, you may have someone that makes too much to qualify for Medicaid, but they aren't in the right situation for being able to get those subsidies or the tax credits on the insurance marketplace. And they get caught in a very sticky situation where they are working, but they just aren't in a place where they can afford or are able to get any assistance to get this insurance. I know we're talking some about what happened in Philadelphia with the House Democrat Policy Committee, but across the state, the Department of Public Welfare has been holding hearings to collect feedback and hear from the public about their input with what's going on with Healthy Pennsylvania. And today's hearing was actually in Harrisburg, and I spent some time with a patient that's actually at one of our health centers. And she was working, and unfortunately now she's on unemployment, and she has been injured, and she wants to get back to work. She's trying to get back to work, but for right now, since COBRA is not an option and she's on unemployment, she doesn't have any insurance. And this would be, she is exactly the type of person that we're talking about with what could happen for Healthy Pennsylvania, because she is below 133% federal poverty level. And it'd be great if we could have something available for her so that she can get better and then be able to move on to getting the next job that she wants to get.
Yeah, you brought up COBRA, and while it was a reasonable thought, I guess, having no way to pay for it kind of made it out of the reach of most people who would need it. Because I remember the one time that I was laid off, and they sent me the COBRA paperwork. It was like $1,300 a month to continue the health insurance that I had. And when you're talking about only making about 40%, because I think that's about the replacement cost of unemployment, about 40 to 45%, I don't know how most people can afford to continue that coverage.
Yeah, it gets very difficult, and that's exactly the situation that she's found herself in. And she wanted to just talk with the department today and try to explain some of her situation and just make it clear that she is not that stereotype of that, unfortunately, like, state gets demonized sometimes. We're talking about this system. She wants to work. She had a job, and she wants to get right back to work. She does not want to sit at home in front of TV or anything. She's anxious to be a productive member of society.
But don't you think that's the majority of people? I mean, it's easy to stereotype one or two bad actors, because you're going to have that in anything that you do along any scale. I think most people, they want to work. They want to have the dignity of work. They want to be able to make their own way, and they don't have to want to ask for anything. And I think, you know, making sure that people have the health security that we all should have should be just a bare minimum right in our society.
And I think, I know, speaking from our health centers, I spend a lot of time in our health centers meeting with our members and their executive staff, and we have our patients are great. We have 700,000 patients that are in our health centers all across the state, and honestly, when I walk into our health centers, I see people that are clearly they're white-collar office workers, they're blue-collar workers, they're their families. There's no one that I would say you could point at and say that fits that horrible stereotype that people have. These are all people that are our neighbors, they're our family, and just like with the population we're talking about that can get this potential insurance product, they're our daycare workers, they're working in our hospitality services. They're the ones that are giving us our coffee when we go to the coffee shop or ordering food at the restaurant. They're people that are working. And it'd be great to make sure we can provide them with some form of insurance that they can stay healthy, their families can stay healthy, and it helps the general public health overall too.
Yeah, for me, Jim, the bottom line is they're people, and you know any reasonable, compassionate society makes sure that even the least among us are taken care of, and this just seems to me to be one of those things that you know, if we're going to call ourselves a compassionate Christian nation, which I don't even want to get into, but if we're going to call ourselves that, this should be the barest of bare minimums. Let me ask you, since the recession, I can't imagine that community health centers have been faring all that well. I got to imagine the demand is getting to the point where it's almost overwhelming. So what would the governor taking the Medicaid expansion money and getting folks insurance, what it would mean to your health centers, what it would mean to the folks that you deal with?
Well, actually, we've seen a significant population growth in our health center since the unfortunate downturn of the economy. The number of patients that are coming in continues to grow. The same goes for the number of patients that have been uninsured that have been coming into our health centers. And to be candid, I know a lot of the conversation about this when it comes to doctors and providers in general is, well, wouldn't it be better for some of the individuals that we're talking about that are uninsured to have some form of insurance that they're going to be coming to get care? And while that's true, we also want to make sure that some of the other things within the Healthy Pennsylvania proposal is that they're able to come into our health centers and be able to be recognized as a member of the provider network if this does go through. There's a couple of, like I said, provisions within Healthy Pennsylvania. One of them is very specific. It's actually asking the federal government for permission, not to get too policy wonkish on anyone, but basically what would be created is within the insurance marketplace, there's what's called qualified health plans. And that basically is just the health insurance plans people will be purchasing. And one of the things that's in this Healthy Pennsylvania proposal is a waiver to not include our community health centers as a provider within the plans that would be available to the newly eligible patients. And one of the things that we've asked for the administration, and just today in the hearing, the Secretary Beverly McArith said she's heard from the concerns from community health centers and they want to take a look at this plan. And that is one of the areas that we're asking them to address, is to allow health centers to be a recognized and supported provider within the qualified health plan, so that if a patient has been a member or a patient of community health centers, they can continue to come if they purchase insurance through this plan.
Now,
of the biggest things this means.
I can't imagine why they would carve you out. I mean, especially if you're I can't imagine why you'd be carved out of this. It sounds like you're being carved out, right?
You can use a lot of different terms for what it is just like. It is a waiver overall, so it's asking to circumvent what some requirements are under the Medicaid laws as it is now. And since this is a commercial product, they're using that as an opportunity to say if this is not Medicaid, this is commercial insurance, they would like to pursue other options. The other is that I think it was just a misperception. There's a lot of misperceptions about community health centers in general, and I think one of them was they didn't understand how we work in the insurance marketplace, not the federal insurance marketplace itself, but commercial insurance overall. So I think, I believe the secretary and members of the administration when they say that they want to take a look at this, but, as it is right now, we are being taken out of the process in terms of being a recognized provider of, qualified health plans within the insurance marketplace right now.
Let me ask you this, Jim, because, you know, there's a very real possibility that the governor's plan is not going to be approved, and I don't see that he has any appetite to take the Medicaid expansion money without his preconditions. What happens to your health centers? What happens to our ERs? What happens to our healthcare system in this state if he doesn't take it and you leave this large portion of the working poor out? To where when they get sick, they end up using the most expensive modes of delivery, the ER and such. Are we not going to see the savings that I think we should by getting everyone insured?
Well, I'm not typically called an optimist, but in this case, me, I am. I think that the administration is genuine and wanted to provide something to the individuals we're talking about. And while I don't think that its current form will be approved, I do think that the administration is going to be working with more of us in Pennsylvania, as well as trying to work things through with the Health and Human Services, the feds, basically. I think there is a real potential for a plan to be approved and one that will be, I think, a better product than what's before us right now. But if it were to go through as it is now, it certainly would have an impact on our health centers. I know it's difficult for them to project what would happen exactly, partially because we haven't seen all the dollars and the projections that the Department of Public Welfare has for this plan. But I know that there are certainly concerns that they would have, but they would need to make difficult decisions in terms of how they would continue to keep the doors open and how many patients they'd be able to see if it went through as it is now. But I am cautiously optimistic that while we all continue to talk, that we might be able to get this plan overall to a better place where that won't happen.
Let's say they pass this plan in a month. How long does it take to get implemented? And this is the part that has me frustrated. I mean, this has been a very long rollout. The whole Affordable Care Act, we're now almost 4 years into the passage.
Right.
How much longer will it take to get to the rollout to make sure that you know, because I know a lot of folks who, you know, they're working low-wage jobs that don't have benefits, and they really thought January 1st, I'm going to have a chance, and then they find out that the main component, this Medicaid piece, isn't there for them.
It's difficult to say how long it'll take exactly. I mean, it certainly takes months of conversations going back and forth between any state and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services when they get to the point of submitting a waiver. I think this isn't something that the administration has certainly given us a timetable. I think there may be an expectation to have this roll out with the state budget. So, we may see that come over the next couple of months within 2014. But I know a lot of what people have been really seeing is the date that a lot of people have targeted is the beginning of 2015 being when we could have, those cards potentially issued.
An entire year.
The negotiations can take, any amount of time. There is no clock for how long it takes to negotiate this. But there's also no clock on how long it takes a state to decide whether they want to opt in or not with Medicaid expansion in itself.
So what are we telling people to do? Last question I've got for you. What's the response? Where's the pressure point?
On the plan itself?
Yeah, I mean to get something passed. I mean I'm of the mindset it makes no sense to me why he hasn't taken the Medicaid expansion money as it was. I understand you want to throw in your preconditions and your thoughts, but every day that goes by, there are people in our community who are struggling. There are community health
Absolutely.
Centers who aren't being funded. There's so much to this that's frustrating. It shows to me a lack of priority and a lack of compassion in my view.
Yeah, I think what I would encourage people to do is there is still a comment period. It runs till unfortunately this Monday, the 13th. The department's listening to what people have to say. Anyone that has any concerns or anyone that wants to make sure that their voice is heard, if they want to just have, you know, pure expansion of Medicaid, expanding the program as it is now, they should look for Healthy Pennsylvania on the Department of Public Welfare's website and tell them that they hear it straight from anyone that feels one way or the other. The same goes if someone doesn't agree with this. But I don't think that ignoring the opportunity to take federal dollars to help people get well, the opportunity to, if we are using a waiver for a Section 1115 waiver, the purpose of it is to be innovative. The purpose of it is to try to find a new way to provide care and give people access to insurance and access to care. And this is the perfect opportunity, like I said, for everyone to come together to try to find a way to craft a product that gets insurance in the hands of 500,000 Pennsylvanians and gives them the ability to go get care, because insurance doesn't equal access, but it certainly is a lot easier for people to have the comfort of going to get care if they're not going to have to worry about going bankrupt just try to pay for some of the medical bills if they're uninsured.
Yeah, right there is where I'm at. If you get sick, you shouldn't go broke, bottom line. Jim Wilshire, appreciate the time. Policy and Partnership Director at the Pennsylvania Association of Community Health Centers. Their website, PACHC.com. We've got a link at the RickSmithShow.com. Jim, thanks so much.
Thanks. Thanks, Rick.
Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Right back.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm John Kerr. After new emails and texts were released on Wednesday linking New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's administration to the bridge closure scandal, Fox News devoted less than 15 minutes to the story that day, compared to more than 2 hours each on CNN and MSNBC. CNN's New Day highlighted the discrepancy with CNN's senior media correspondent Brian Stelter.
There were so many fewer mentions of the story on Fox that it got people wondering what was going on. With 2016 on the horizon, Fox News is an important place for Republicans or for conservatives to hear about these candidates. And if they don't hear a lot about this scandal, they may not take it as serious.
On his radio show, Rush Limbaugh seemed to confirm these suspicions.
The media, with the exception of Fox, which is probably, if it's safe to say, in the Christie camp, the media is salivating now at the prospect that Christie's career is over.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
And finally, we don't have unions in South Carolina. I wear heels, and it's not for a fashion statement. It's because we kick, and we kick those unions hard, and they will not step foot in the state of South Carolina.
Yeah, we kick those wages right in the behind, make sure that we've got those poverty wages. And look, I'm telling you, at the end of it, what these folks who are running the General Assembly are telling us, by even bringing up the idea of the no rights at work agenda, this right to work, or the assault on public sector workers, or fighting against minimum wage, or fighting against the Medicaid expansion. What they're saying is we don't care about working people. And I think one of the things, I think what the recession brought home to a lot of people is that we're all fairly close to that poverty line. And it just takes one misstep, another one of these tragedies, and we're all right there. And understand, had it not been for unemployment, had it not been for Social Security, had it not been for food stamps, had it not been for the New Deal initiatives and the War on Poverty initiatives, 2008, it's the depression of 2008. And we don't get out of it. Because you've got a Republican Party who's hell-bent on no intervention whatsoever. That's their policy. Get government out of the way and we'll have a harder down, like Pat Toomey said. So we would have had the crash. People would have lost, more people would have lost their homes. More people would have lost their wealth. But then we would have eventually bounced back. But after how much pain, how much suffering, and how much loss. That's the Republican view. It's that simple. Let's take a quick break. Right back with hour three of the program. If you missed any portion of the Rick Smith Show, download the podcast at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Right back.
Changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to Win
Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. On the 50th anniversary of President Lyndon B. Johnson's war on poverty, the U.S. Senate is closer to extending unemployment benefits for another 3 months for long-term jobless workers. A few Republicans have joined the Democrats to vote to advance the legislation. Republicans, though, are trying to get more budget cuts in return for extending the benefits. President Obama is urging Congress to extend the jobless benefits. The official poverty rate was 19% during the Johnson administration, and it's 15% now. Right-wing conservatives fought the anti-poverty programs then and continue to oppose them now. But even with the opposition that limited the effectiveness of the war on poverty, tens of millions of people have still been lifted out of poverty. According to the Census Bureau, anti-poverty programs kept 41 million Americans out of poverty in 2012. These programs include food assistance, unemployment compensation, Social Security, and earned income tax credits. About 1,200 French workers are losing their jobs at a Goodyear plant, and they're not happy with the severance pay. They held two managers captive for a few hours, threatening to detain them until the company agreed to pay out big severance amounts to the workers. The unions representing the workers want the equivalent of $110,000 in severance pay, plus about $3,400 per each year worked. French police freed the managers, but the French government doesn't severely prosecute these manager abductions, seeing them as acts of desperation and not as serious felony crimes of kidnapping as they would be treated in the U.S. After the managers were freed, workers continued their protests at the plant, including burning about 100,000 euros worth of Goodyear tires. When a plant closes in France, the entire international operation of the owner of the plant is taken into account when it comes to how the closing is handled. French workers have used the capture the boss and hold them tactic several times over the years as one of many tactics to win better compensation or working conditions. The Workers' Organizing Committee of Chicago helped Snarf sandwich shop workers protest what they say are unfair terminations of workers. The rally Wednesday at 2 Prudential Plaza in Chicago demanded the reinstatement of the fired workers and furlough payments. All of the workers at the Snarfs at 600 West Chicago were fired December 22nd. They were fired by email without notice just 3 days before Christmas. The St. Louis Show Me 15 campaign staged a protest in solidarity with the Chicago action and with the fired Chicago Snarf workers on Wednesday. Snarf is a national sandwich shop chain. The workers have filed NLRB complaints. Hundreds of supporters have called on Snarf to reinstate the workers.
This is a very sad day for 100,000 workers who are wondering what their future will hold.
We cannot afford to lose this fight. This is the end of everything that we built over 75 years.
Say if a machine breaks down, they would actually take gray duct tape to tape it up.
Listener support is vital to keep these worker voices on the radio news airwaves. Support Workers Independent News now by donating at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
You gotta wonder, you know, fight for what's right. You know, the more I pay attention, the more I see the news reports, especially over at Fake News on Fox. It just blows my mind. This guy John Stossel, who I just think is a right wing crank. I can't believe the guy's even on television yet alone. Anybody would pay attention to, but he had a really interesting statement this morning, where he said that what the war on poverty did is it taught women. Better not have a man in your house because you'll get more money if there's no guy there. And he went on to say so people just adjusted their behavior and now they want more handout. They don't want to work the handout. They want more of it. And this seems to be the radical right. I mean, the fringe right point of view. And I got to tell you, our mainstream media is spending a lot of time, an awful lot of time in my view, talking about this, which is why we've asked our good friend Craig Harrington, economic researcher over at Media Matters for America, to come talk to us about what they're seeing over at Media Matters. Craig, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on again.
You know, I look at this statement and, you know, Stossel saying, yeah, you know, so what? 1% owns 35% of everything in the country. So what? You're going to have inequality when you have freedom. And, you know, it's that insane mentality that I think some in this country truly believe, and maybe some others just drank the Kool-Aid.
Well, it's actually true. A lot of people, specifically the sort of libertarian not really libertarian, but sort of fringe right that claims to be libertarian, particularly in right-wing media and right-wing political circles. They argue almost in favor of economic inequality because there being a great deal of inequality, there being this threat, this looming threat posed from poverty, in their view, it provides you that impetus to really be out and be a go-getter. Just this morning, you know, John Stossel, before he made the atrocious comments that he made about women who are seeking handouts by trying to become unwed mothers, you know, John Stossel was talking with Stuart Varney, who's the Fox Business host, and the two of them agreed that, you know, inequality was a good thing because it provided us with that impetus to really go out there and try to make our lives better. And just sort of a perverse mentality where you wouldn't be trying to make everyone's lives better. You'd just be trying to work for your own benefit against some sort of machine trying to drag you down. It's a strange way to look at the world, but in the right-wing media, at least, it's the normal.
Yeah, but I look at this, and this is Reagan-era rhetoric on steroids. I mean, this the hooray for me and screw everybody else. This is it to the umpteenth power.
Yeah, and particularly with yesterday being the 50th anniversary of Lyndon Johnson's speech where he declared a war on poverty, it's very interesting to see the way the right-wing media has responded to sort of anti-poverty relief programs that have gone into effect in the United States. You know, continually over and over again, virtually every Fox TV show all day long for the last several days has had at least one segment dedicated to the war on poverty and how it failed. And next week, we'll actually be putting out a video where we compile a few of the worst in terms of the offensive things said about, you know, things like unemployment benefits. But it doesn't have to be unemployment benefits. Unemployment benefits is topical because they just lapsed on December 28th.
Right.
And 1.3 million people lost really what is, for most of them, their only cash income. But it doesn't have to be that. It can be any program. The right-wing media and the political sphere that is emboldened by that media will take any chance they can to chip away at virtually every social safety net and anti-poverty relief program, food stamps, welfare, unemployment benefits, Social Security, even Medicare. It doesn't really matter so long as it fits their anti-government narrative.
What I find interesting, though, and talking to people who buy this right-wing media garble, is that they focus on food stamps. They focus on programs that are meant to help the very poor. Never really spent a lot of time talking about Medicare, which is wildly popular, and the job training programs and the educational opportunities that came out of it. Not much about that. It's always focused on the entire war on poverty was just this one little sliver. And I got to be honest with you. When I hear them say that failure, I look in the mirror and I go, I got to be honest. I think I'm living example of that it worked. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. I now live in a neighborhood with doctors and lawyers. And it was those programs that gave me that helping hand to move forward and millions of other people like me. So I got to be honest. I think this strategy that Roger Ailes and the fake news that Fox people are pulling, I think it has to backfire because I got to think that there are millions of people like me who remember our past.
And, you know, it's not just anecdotal evidence from people like you and millions of people like you who grew up in poverty or faced poverty at some point in their life and were drawn out of it because of this concerted state, local, and federal government effort to alleviate poverty. But, you know, the fact is borne out in the results. You know, you can calculate it. I've written on this on MediaMatters.org just a couple of days ago. We've had a few people write about the same study. There was a study from the Columbia Population Research Center which used the supplemental poverty measure, which is the only sort of uniform measure of poverty across decades, coming out of the Census Bureau, and they found that poverty rates have actually been cut almost 40% due to government action. And so if you use the more comprehensive measure of poverty, the supplemental poverty measure, or SPM, you find that the poverty rate in the United States used to be 26%, which is mind-boggling. In 1967, 26% of Americans lived in poverty, and today, when you take into effect after-tax transfers and after-tax credits, only 16% of the American population lives below the poverty line.
Which is still too high, correct?
Specifically, yeah, it's certainly too high. You know, you're still talking about more than 1 in 8 Americans dealing with poverty. But that's still a 40% reduction over the last 5 decades. And in the right-wing media, they say, well, you know, it's not enough. You know, the argument against anti-poverty programs is that if you spend a dime and poverty still exists, then it was a dime wasted. They don't look at how you're able to ameliorate the effects of poverty, how you're able to make the suffering of the impoverished less insufferable and how to make life better for people who are living at the bottom. They just look at everything as being a waste if it doesn't give them immediate gratification.
Yeah, and what's interesting to me is I think the recession of 2008 taught a lot of us that, you know, at any point, the reality is we could be facing poverty ourselves. And I remember saying for years, don't wish these programs away because you're going to need them. And in my view, a lot of the New Deal programs, a lot of the Great Society programs saved this nation from depression. I mean, we had a horrible recession, but those programs saved us from depression.
Yeah, when you look at something like Social Security, which is this sort of quintessential New Deal program, there was a time when 90% of seniors lived in poverty if they didn't have some sort of help from their family, from their children and grandchildren. 90%. That's the 1920s. You look at the 2010s, and 90% of seniors don't live in poverty. So the metric has flipped on its head as a direct result of Social Security, which specifically pays enough to keep people above the federal poverty line. Now, there's a good economic argument and a good moral argument that it still doesn't pay enough to give people a good quality of life and a good standard of living that they've earned through 40, 50, 60 years of working in this country. But the fact is, Social Security flipped the poverty metrics for seniors on its head, and Social Security is still on the chopping block every single day in the right-wing media and in the political sphere that feeds off of it.
Yeah, but what's interesting to me, Craig, is that, you know, the people who are dead set against it, the ideologues, the people who have been fighting progress for working poor, for poor people in this country from the inception, pretty much, you know, their party was against the New Deal, against the Great Society, against the War on Poverty, against all of this stuff. And
these are
got
the strike breakers from the 1880s. Too.
Exactly. There you go. Perfect example. And, you know, dead set against it, and facts be damned. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know if you saw this collection of data that Paula Page had done up in Maine, where they went and they found that there are 3,000 transactions from the EBT cards done in bars and sports bars and in strip clubs. And you go, 3,000 out of 1.8 million is...
Yeah.
Well, I think anybody would want to have a rate that low, but nobody asked the question, are those the only ATM machines in the areas where the people who are using those cards live?
Yeah, and that's the sort of problem that you find with all this anecdotal evidence. You know, you look at the Cato Institute, which is ostensibly a reputable academic think tank here in D.C., and they had a paper about local anti-poverty fraud, like you're talking about in Maine, and all of their so-called citation for this academic study was like local news reports, where, you know, four people were reported as fraudsters by, you know, WEBN or whatever in some little town or hamlet on a TV report in the evening news. And that was their evidence, this anecdotal evidence that trumps up fraud rates. The fact of the matter is, you take a program like Medicare, it has an efficiency of over 97%. You take something like supplemental nutrition assistance, what the Fox people and the right-wing media people always call food stamps derisively. But you take food stamps, you've got a fraud rate of less than 2%. You're talking about 1.3% fraud, abuse, and trafficking combined. If J.P. Morgan Chase had that kind of efficiency, they would be doing backflips in the street.
Yeah,
but instead, we attack tiny, minute amounts of fraud, minute amounts of welfare abuse. In Florida, you spend millions of dollars drug testing welfare recipients to save a few hundred dollars in payments returned to the state. It's just absurd.
But isn't it interesting that we tend to want to punish those folks at the bottom who need help? But, you know, the big banksters, when they collapsed our economy, it was the bailout was two pages long, and whatever you want. Doesn't it seem odd to you?
It's actually a really interesting comment. You know, like Robert Reich, who's a very prominent economist, he's a professor at University of California, and he has a project that he did with the Economic Policy Institute called Inequality Is. And as part of that project, he has a video where he talks about the fact that when the bankers ran out of money and when the bankers gambled too much and when the bankers blew up the financial economy, America's taxpayers stepped up and saved them. But who's saving the American taxpayers? It's certainly not the super rich or the extremely profitable corporations. They're continuing to argue that they need to have lower tax rates and they need to have lower burdens from this society that helped enrich them and helped empower them. they want to have less and less to do with keeping that society functioning. But we're the ones who provided them a backstop, but there's no providing backstop for underwater mortgages, and there's a continual war on the war on poverty. There's a war on the poor, if you could say so. And there's a continual effort by right-wing media and right-wing political spheres to roll back civil rights and roll back access to health care. And all of that, it doesn't make any sense if you're living in a society that was making honest policies and reasonable policies. Everything is just it's pitting one against the other.
Yeah, and always looking down on the people behind you.
Constantly looking down.
That's the thing that always infuriated me. But, you know, I go back to, you know, the 1964, you know, 50 years ago, and I remember something that I read about A. Philip Randolph, who said, you know, he was angry that there were what appeared to be handout programs. What A. Philip Randolph wanted were jobs programs. Instead of saying, we're going to give you food stamps if you need it, he wanted a job program, be it whatever, kind of like Germany's done, where if you collect any type of unemployment or any type of food stamps or assistance, they give you something to do. That's what he wanted to do. Do you think had we gone that path, where, you know, you're working for it and the appearances that you're working for, that the right wouldn't have an argument, or would they still find a flaw in it?
Well, during the New Deal era, there was actually a very similar government jobs program called the Civilian Conservation Corps.
Right.
And the right-wing opposition to it was very loud and extreme as well. So I think given the nature of the sort of politics we have today, it would be very easy for right-wing media and right-wing political actors to be against a directed jobs program. But the problem is the American people would probably be very happy to see that. You know, if you took the 1.3 million long-term unemployed who are at home essentially being paid to apply for jobs, they're being paid to look for work by an insurance policy that they bought while they were working. But if they were instead being given the same amount of monetary incentive to go and do something, you know, even if it was just paving highways or building schools or providing environmental retrofits to buildings in inner cities, that would be more beneficial to the economy because they'd be learning skills while also providing this value added. And at the same time, it would have the same benefit of these cash handouts. So those kinds of jobs programs would be extremely popular once they started going and people started getting involved with them. And that's one of the reasons that you see the opposition, because, you know, that was something that boosted the Roosevelt administration for four election cycles, was the fact that you had this constant infusion of jobs, employment, and money into the economy to build in that growth. And we don't have that in response to this recession. But, you know, if you had a Nobel Prize in economics, you were calling for that in 2009. Your calls just weren't heard in Washington.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I look at it, there are so many things that aren't being done. And we have a friend that lives in Germany, and he says, you know, if you're in one of these situations, you know, they'll give you, your job is to clean these three bus stops. And that's your job. And every day you got up and you went and you did your job and you collected your paycheck. I like the way you put it. We're paying people to sit home and paying people to apply for jobs. And I would add to that, I think we're paying people to bring wages down, because the more folks out there who are applying for jobs, the more of the unemployed are out there, the more that you're going to see employers go, we don't have to give any raises. In fact, we can take money back and benefits back and make conditions worse.
Of course, it's important to note that even though unemployment benefits aren't the optimal solution to the economic problems we have today, cutting them is the worst solution.
Oh, it's insane.
You know, one of the things that we're going to see, you know, I'm a little skeptical about whether or not we're able to reinstate the unemployment benefits given the budgetary negotiations required to even get the budget that we have now that cut them. But if we're not able to reinstate these unemployment benefits to the long-term unemployed, what we're going to see in the January 2014 numbers, which come out the first week of February, we're going to see a large drop in the unemployment rate.
Right.
But we're also going to see a large bump in the labor force, in the population that is not part of the labor force. And so what you provide with these unemployment benefits is you keep these people attached to the workforce. And when you cut those benefits, you just kick them out of the system entirely. The right wing will point to the drop in the unemployment rate and say, look, those people went and got jobs. But in fact, if they did get jobs, they got minimum wage jobs, which means they're still probably receiving federal benefits because most minimum wage employees receive federal benefits. So we're still losing money there. But in most cases, what we're going to see is people just kicked out entirely, and now they're forced to survive God knows how.
Excellent, excellent point. So do you think, you know, last line of questioning, do you think that we're going to see the unemployment benefits go through? I mean, on the Senate, they moved it along. I don't see any appetite in the House to pass it without huge pounds of flesh, but I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Well, it would be easy enough to simply agree to some sort of offset. Whether or not the Democrats are willing to do that is uncertain. What it seems like is a three-month extension is the most likely thing that we're going to get, if we get anything. But even that, it's hard to tell. All I know is the right-wing media is against any extension of unemployment benefits unless we're cutting somewhere else. And if we're going to extend unemployment benefits, what we're going to cut funding for National Science Foundation or housing subsidization or some other benefit program that helps low-income and middle-class people, then it's not worth it.
Yeah, I gotta be
because
honest.
There's no sense in robbing Paul to pay Peter.
Yeah, I almost fell off my chair when I heard the guy on Fox say that there's this thing that they want us to believe, this mythical thing called a multiplier, that they didn't believe that there's any multiple effect when you spend a dollar of unemployment in your local community, that there's a reverberation that creates jobs. I just find it interesting how they're doing everything they can do, even if it's a bold-faced lie, to attack these programs. It's just mind-blowing.
The money multiplier is Econ 101. When you see a right-wing media personality say that they don't believe in this mythical multiplier effect, that is exactly the same as denying climate change and the science behind it. I mean, the money multiplier, how big it is or how often it will have the same return is questionable. But the fact that it exists is just simple math. The GDP has a component, and part of that is consumer spending. And if you boost consumer spending by taking money out of the government and giving it to people, you're going to boost GDP, at least in the short term. It's just a fact. Yeah. How long it will work remains to be seen, but the denial of its existence is absurd.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Craig Harrington, it's always great talking with you. Appreciate the time, man.
Thank you.
Craig Harrington, economic researcher over at Media Matters for America. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Have you had your daily minimum requirement of triclosan today? How about your dosage of triclocarban? Chances are you have, but don't know it. These two are antimicrobial chemicals, which might sound like a good thing, except that they disrupt the human body's normal regulatory processes. Animal studies show, for example, that these triclos can be linked to the scrambling of hormones in children, disruption of puberty and of the reproductive system, decreases in thyroid hormone levels that affect brain development, and other serious health problems. Yet corporations have slipped them into all sorts of consumer products, pushing them with a blitz of advertising that claim the antibacterial ingredients prevent the spread of infections. The two chemicals were originally meant for use by surgeons to cleanse their hands before operations. But that tiny application has now proliferated like a plague, constantly exposing practically everyone to small amounts here, there, and everywhere, adding up to dangerous megadoses. Triclosan and triclocarban were first mixed into soaps. But then, boom, brand-name corporations went wild, putting these hormone disruptors into about 2,000 products, including toothpaste, mouthwashes, fabrics, and, most astonishingly, even into baby pacifiers. Today, use of the chemicals is so prevalent that they can be found in the urine of 3/4 of Americans. They also accumulate in groundwater and soil, so they saturate our environment and eventually ourselves. One study found them in the breast milk of 97% of women tested. This is Jim Hightower saying, for decades, corporate lobbying and regulatory meekness let this chemical menace spread. But now, the Food and Drug Administration is finally questioning the continued use of the two triclos. For more information and action, go to the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. You know, I go back to this Stossel quote, and you know, it's one of those things that I get it. You're a right-wing crank, and you're trying to be outrageous and trying to gain some attention. But I think it's dumb, but the sad reality is there are a number of people who have bought this, that, well, by giving food stamps and an ability for women to raise their children, that somehow they've sent men away is ridiculous on so many levels. What I find amazing is that there are people who buy into this. The sad reality of what goes on is you have women who get pregnant and then they've got the kid. There's no way to run from that. What we should have been doing all along, honestly, is we should have been going after the deadbeats who sire these children and then take off. And I think back to my own father, somebody who should have been paying all along, but just wandered away. Should have been going after that. Now, the other side of this Stossel thing that gets me, these are the same people who say we shouldn't be educating people about sex. We shouldn't be going after and pursuing birth control and contraception, and the same people who, you know, we're going to take it to the Supreme Court, no contraception. So the same people who are out there screaming, oh, people have 10, 15 kids, like Louis Gohmert, who claims that the only reason he's in Congress is because, well, he saw a woman with 15 kids, and they were getting welfare checks. That's the only reason he went to Congress, was to be able to steal money back from, to take back from them. It's the only reason, he says. Which is kind of odd. That you would go, well, maybe there's an idea of how we can fix it that doesn't happen. Instead of saying we're going to cut that off because one person or a handful of people or a very small percentage are in this situation, we're going to take it away from everybody. It shows to me some weird pathology. And I guess it's, you know, it's angry man syndrome, maybe. I don't know. And I look at Stossel and Gohmert and the type that would say, well, they're shunning men, as probably the kind of guys that, you know, women probably wouldn't want to be around anyway. Just a thought. But here's the thing. These are the same people who want to take us back to this mythical age of the 50s. And maybe they want to go back to the age of the 50s where women were solely dependent on men. You know, I remember hearing stories, again, I go back to my childhood being very fortunate that my mother worked in a nursing home, able to hear the stories of the past and, you know, the stories of the good old days and, well, the not so good old days. And the 1950s were not the good old days for a lot of women. They were controlled. They were basically held hostage because they didn't have the opportunity to go out on their own because they were saddled with the kids. And the workforce was not a really friendly place. It's not a place where you were going to make a decent living. There's always been this gender bias in wages. And I know, I keep hearing people tell me, oh, no, they make the same as men. Nonsense. We both know that's not true. So I look at this, and you got to wonder, those who pine for those mythical good old days, how much of it is that as well? Now, for me, I go back to the welfare reform thing that Clinton did back in the 90s. What I said back then was, okay, if you're going to take benefits away, you've got to have a path to a job. Not just say, hey, you got to go out and get a job, but actually have mechanisms in place to where, okay, you're going to go into the workforce. Who's going to take care of your kids? How are you going to get there? Actually being able to help in those veins instead of saying, just go. Because I grew up in a place where we weren't on the bus line. So good luck finding a job in our little four-block area. And it's much like I talked about last night about Governor LePage's little survey of 1.8 million electronic bank transfer purchases done with the EBT cards. And they found 3,000 that could have been that were done at bars, sports bars, or strip clubs, without any real explanation. I mean, it's really anecdotal. I mean, think about 3,000 of those. That's it. 3,000. That's all. That's 0.2%, as the Bangor Daily News pointed out. But nobody ever said, "Well, is it possible that was the only machine in the area? Is it possible that that's where these folks worked?" No, you don't hear that. It's just about demonizing. It's about tearing down. It's about putting a stigma on these people who need help. And I got to be honest, I had hoped during the Great Recession that would have kind of gone away. And we would have just said, you know, we're the most prosperous nation in the world. At least we can do is make sure that people have enough to eat. Could be wrong, though. Could be. Maybe retribution, maybe punitive. Retribution is what we need, and punishment and pain and misery and suffering. Maybe that's the America. Good biblical Old Testament fire and brimstone. Yeah. Let's take a quick break. Right back with Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. On the 50th anniversary of President Lyndon B. Johnson's war on poverty, the U.S. Senate is closer to extending unemployment benefits for another 3 months for long-term jobless workers. A few Republicans have joined the Democrats to vote to advance the legislation. Republicans, though, are trying to get more budget cuts in return for extending the benefits. President Obama is urging Congress to extend the jobless benefits. The official poverty rate was 19% during the Johnson administration. And it's 15% now. Right-wing conservatives fought the anti-poverty programs then and continue to oppose them now. But even with the opposition that limited the effectiveness of the war on poverty, tens of millions of people have still been lifted out of poverty. According to the Census Bureau, anti-poverty programs kept 41 million Americans out of poverty in 2012. These programs include food assistance, unemployment compensation, Social Security, and earned income tax credits. About 1,200 French workers are losing their jobs at a Goodyear plant, and they're not happy with the severance pay. They held two managers captive for a few hours, threatening to detain them until the company agreed to pay out big severance amounts to the workers. The unions representing the workers want the equivalent of $110,000 in severance pay, plus about $3,400 per each year worked. French police freed the managers, but the French government doesn't severely prosecute these manager abductions, seeing them as acts of desperation and not as serious felony crimes of kidnapping as they would be treated in the U.S. After the managers were freed, workers continued their protests at the plant, including burning about 100,000 euros worth of Goodyear tires. When a plant closes in France, the entire international operation of the owner of the plant is taken into account when it comes to how the closing is handled. French workers have used the capture the boss and hold them tactic several times over the years as one of many tactics to win better compensation or working conditions. The Workers' Organizing Committee of Chicago helped Snarf sandwich shop workers protest what they say are unfair termination of workers. The rally Wednesday at 2 Prudential Plaza in Chicago demanded the reinstatement of the fired workers and furlough payments. All of the workers at the Snarfs at 600 West Chicago were fired December 22nd. They were fired by email without notice just 3 days before Christmas. The St. Louis Show Me 15 campaign staged a protest in solidarity with the Chicago action and with the fired Chicago Snarf workers on Wednesday. Snarf is a national sandwich shop chain. The workers have filed NLRB complaints. Hundreds of supporters have called on Snarf to reinstate
compensate the workers.
This is a very sad day for 100,000 workers who are wondering what their future will hold.
We cannot afford to lose this fight. This is the end of everything that we built over 75 years.
Say if a machine breaks down, they would actually take gray duct tape to tape it up.
Listener support is vital to keep these worker voices on the radio news airwaves. Support Workers Independent News now by donating at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org. The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So if you had anything other than Fox News on today, all you saw was Benghazi. Bridge Ghazi. I love that. Bridge Ghazi or Bridge Gate. All about Chris Christie and his administration. And the retribution. Anybody surprised at this? I'm not. When you've got somebody with that personality, he attracts people. Whether you believe he was in on it or not, I think he just attracts that kind of person. But you know, we'll find out more about it. I've got Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service, on the line. Luke, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, good to talk to you. I said that Bridge Ghazi is not the only funny name enjoying a renaissance. We'll get to it later, but we've got a nanny gate coming up also, a recycling of the 1993 allegations against Clinton. So this is a good year to be writing headlines. I
love everything gate. I mean, we've since Watergate, everything's been whatever gate. And the new Bridge Gate was the first thing, but I look at this. Did Chris Christie know? Do you think he knew?
You know, I'm not in a position to speculate. He's certainly one who's been known to extract, revenge on people for personal slights. He certainly is, I think, doing damage control in the right way, though. I mean,
absolutely,
that we can judge him on. You compare the way he conducted himself today, giving a 107-minute press conference, which, you know, I've seen some wordy, statements given at the podium at the UN, but 107 minutes is really going above and beyond. And then going to the town where, Fort Lee, I believe it was, where the closures were really felt, and where things were really screwed up for about 4 days. You contrast that with, the Port Authority appointee, who was really the one who received that message about, hey, it's time for some traffic jam. And that was the guy who apparently carried out the order. He went in front of the New Jersey Assembly today. He was sworn in, and then more than 20 times, he invoked the Fifth Amendment and wouldn't answer any questions, to the extent that lawmakers actually are going to see if they can find him to be in contempt of the committee and face the criminal charges. So
wow,
that is not the way to go about doing damage control.
No, that's not it at all. The only thing that I thought Chris Christie probably could have done better, go to one of the truck stops around Fort Lee there, where all the truck drivers who sat for hours getting through that mess had to be, and face them. That would have been the next step, in my view.
Look, I think if this was just an insult that affected the mayor, people wouldn't be so concerned. But the real people who suffered were the commuters who are already paying, and I can testify to this living in New York, some really crazy tolls to enter the city. I don't even know what it is, like $14 or something to come in and out of New York on the bridge tunnel. So you add insult to injury by slowing those people down. I know there's good stories of school buses being held up and ambulances failing to reach people. That really does extract punishment. Punishment is being taken out on the people here, and I think that really is wrong. No matter, you know, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or someone who thinks Christie is a strong candidate in 2016. In fact, I still consider him to be probably a very strong contender, regardless of this. But it was a very regrettable way of carrying out political retribution. We can say that for sure.
Yeah, for a car to get over that bridge, it's $13. Just for a car, for trucks to get over it, you know, like one of the big trucks, $102 to get over the bridge.
Cool.
$102. And you think about it, it's backed up. As someone who's driven a truck for years for a living, I can attest, you could sit hours waiting to get over that bridge. Always hated going that way. And you know, it is the busiest bridge in the country. And really to do that to me just signals a willingness to not really give a damn about your constituents.
Look, I agree with you. I've had a conversation about this with a number of people some who actually know folks within the Christie campaign, and then they shrugged this off, saying that people will like his sort of hardball style. And I agree to a large extent. It is still, I wouldn't say this is refreshing. It is to people who are very far away from the issue, rather comical, and, you know, takes on a sort of a visceral quality that I still think is refreshing in this age of sort of, you know, real passive aggression in politics. But again, you hit the personal level. It really is, you know, you kind of want people to file a class action lawsuit against their time loss. I mean, people spend so many hours in their cars. And this may not be the end of it from a legal standpoint either. The New Jersey U.S. Attorney announced today they're going to be conducting a full investigation here to find out if Christie's administration broke some laws. And there are some pretty big laws that actually could be broken here. Interstate commerce issues, obstruction of justice, political intimidation are all laws that could have been violated you know, when these lane closures were carried out purely for political reasons. So this story is not going to go away with the end of today's news cycle like Christie, I think, hoped it would.
Yeah, I was talking to a friend of mine who works for UPS, and he was saying UPS would sue him just because of all of the missed appointments that they had, all of the fuel they wasted, all of the things that ended up because they were stuck there for so long, and all of the companies. And you're right, on the commerce side of it, it's huge.
Yeah, I can't imagine how many hundreds of millions of dollars transferred over that bridge, especially when you factor in those tolls there. So, you know, bring it on. I really hate encouraging more people to become lawyers just to carry out lawsuits in this country. But, man, if there's ever one that's a juicy settlement, I think this is where you go.
Yeah, but, you know, one of the things that caught me, and I understand, you know, being petulant and playing these little games, but, you know, when the one person identified, well, I feel sorry for the children, and the other person emailed back, well, those are voters of that guy, so I don't feel bad for him. I just, what a snot.
Yeah, you start to bring these, you know, if there is an equivalent for the town you're broadcasting in or, Brooklyn area that I live in, I wouldn't want to imagine what it would be. It would be, if they shut down the subway line for a borough of Brooklyn that didn't endorse something that Bloomberg had done. You know, that really extracts revenge on hundreds of thousands of people and really screws up people's lives. So I've sort of run out of sympathy.
Or shutting down a lane on the BQE, something along those
right,
lines.
Exactly.
Just nuts. Also, since we're in New York, evidently the Nannygate thing popped up again. Tell me, what's this about?
Well, this was a woman named Devyani Kobragade. She's a very pretty young woman who was working at the consulate at the Indian government in New York. And in December, she was arrested by the U.S. Marshal's Office after dropping off her kids at school and charged with having, fraudulently filled out the immigration documents to get some domestic help into the United States from India to work at her house. She was charged not only for falsifying these documents, but for trying to pay this woman who allegedly worked like 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. at night about a third of New York's minimum wage. That's pretty bad just on its own. But then an interesting dynamic popped up where she was arrested, taken to a central booking in Manhattan, and the marshal gave her a strip search.
Ooh.
And this really pissed off the Indian government, claimed that she had diplomatic immunity because she was working in the consulate. It's funny. There was a lot of other things going on December 12th when this came out, because I remember I couldn't get around to writing about it at the time. But the U.S. really didn't do very good damage control on this. Carrie, was asked about it a number of times and didn't express any sympathy. And so in the intervening month or so, this turned into a huge issue in India. There's just every day you open the Indian papers and there are op-eds against the Americans. This is a diplomatic relationship that's always been pretty cordial. And now, there are things like the embassy in New Delhi, India, is being forced to shut down a pool club that they have there, saying that they're violating tax status by giving away tax-exempt beers and hamburgers to Americans.
Wow.
So, she was charged in district court today, indicted on these charges, but just hours before that, the U.S. government granted her diplomatic immunity as a member of the U.N. staff, of size into my feet, as a member of the U.N. mission for India, and now she's being asked to leave the country because apparently, even though this indictment came through, she has full immunity now and will be going back to India. So perhaps closing the book on this 2013-2014 Nannygate, but kind of an interesting story, and the reactions to India really are visceral. It's amazing just to see how set up with the U.S. they've gotten over this one incident.
Yeah, that's amazing. And at the end of it, all of this turned around, and nobody's going to jail.
Probably not.
So it just seemed like an exercise in futility that probably was going to end up in that position from the beginning. Why not just go through the process and get them pushed out of the country anyway? Because you're not going to hold them accountable.
Hey, I'll tell you, diplomatic status is something we should all try to do. I remember coming in with Zach after coming back from Jordan, and we were standing at the immigration line in New York, and there was just a young girl who was with a huge group of people, and she said, "Oh, I have diplomatic status," and apparently she did, but everyone in line was joking, "How can this 14-year-old girl be a diplomat?" And, you know, it's family privilege, and it's, I'm a little suspicious of whether everyone working in a huge consulate for a country of a billion people in the U.S., should be enjoying such privilege against illegality, but that's the system we've created, I guess.
Well, but I mean, if anybody who watched Lethal Weapon, I think 6, 7, 10, 15, whichever one it was, that's where I learned about diplomatic immunity, thanks to Mel Gibson and Danny Glover.
Hey, got a lot of perks, apparently.
Let's move on. Speaking of diplomatic interest, the president of Afghanistan, what's this, releasing people who've killed Americans?
Well, the president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, and the U.S. have been failing over the past few weeks to come to a long-term security agreement about how U.S. troops will remain in the country past 2014. And, you know, you've got to wonder whether that's even a good idea in the first place when you look at, the way Iraq has turned up just over the past few weeks. But anyways, the president announced today that he will release 72 prisoners convicted of killing Americans without a trial. And then he said, he's doing this because the U.S. still operates these black prisons, as they're called, where torture is still occurring, and then he threatens to release even more dangerous criminals in the weeks ahead. So I don't know how these two parties are going to get together and agree on something where participation on the Iraqi side is really crucial to the U.S. wanting to go forward. I think there are a lot of people in Washington who are rightfully questioning whether Hamid Karzai can be trusted to stick up for his signature on any document, and particularly anything that involves American soldiers at this point.
We're just now coming around to that?
Yeah, well, that's, again, what I'm saying is, you know, they're trying to work out this long-term agreement. If they can't, the EU and the U.S. say they're going to cut off billions of dollars of development aid, which is slated to go to Afghanistan. And, look, I don't want to put on my opinion hat too much, but one starts to wonder whether that's even worth it, getting that money in the first place at this point. The president of Afghanistan really showing that he would almost rather rule in Afghanistan where the U.S. are thousands of miles away than, being there or at least giving their money to the country. So a real insult to Washington coming from Afghanistan.
Interesting. Also, I saw something that kind of made me chuckle. The NBA's losing popularity. And I guess the NHL, good for them moving forward, right?
Yeah, hey, I'm a hockey fan. This is good news for me. The NHL surpassed the NBA today in terms of sellout games. I don't think it really actually occurred today, but someone dug up the numbers, and there are 15 NHL markets, including, I think, the closest one to you, the Philadelphia Flyers, that are averaging sellouts at every one of their home games.
Yeah, they're huge.
You compare that to 8 NBA teams, and I think a lot of this owes itself to the real discrepancy, at least in the NBA. There are teams that just keep doing well. You look at the Miami Heat just going to the finals every year. And then a whole bunch of stinkers that are having trouble selling out, whereas in the NHL, there's a lot more teams than the Knicks. The star players get fouls called on them, unlike LeBron James. I know there's a video going around of him taking 8 steps or something like that and not getting called for traveling. People are just saying, this is everything wrong with professional basketball now. So that and probably a few other factors are causing terrible hockey teams like the Winnipeg Jets and the Calgary Flames to still be selling out their home games every day, just like the Bruins, the Blackhawks, and the Red Wings, and all those real classic teams. So good news for hockey. Their marketing strategy really seems to be paying off.
Yeah, I mean, see, hockey started off kind of like wrestling. It's kind of moved a little bit away from it. Basketball is going towards the wrestling model.
European football. You know, I think that's the corollary of complaining about fouls. But I think a lot of hockey fans are happy they don't have to worry about when they turn on those games, see these guys just picking themselves up after being, you know, hit in the face with a stick. They're never there to complain about the penalties or the aggression.
And I think that's part of it. You look at some of the characters you see in basketball. I think a lot of people see them as unpalatable. You know, I look at Dennis Rodman, who I never liked as a player and only got really insanely weird at the end of his career. And now, well, he's got this love affair going with Kim Jong-un. But I think that has a lot to do with it as well.
Hey, and there was also a guy on the New York Knicks today who was fined by the NBA for this stunt he was doing, where when he'd go to the foul line and line up next to a guy, he would untie his shoes. He did this, I guess, a number of times during the games. These guys are making millions of dollars, and the Knicks especially are a terrible team. So I think the sympathy is running a little bit low on the NBA. maybe that's, again, one of the reasons we're seeing a resurgence in the hard-hitting, no apologies, NHL.
Yeah. What do you think? What are we hearing about Rodman? I know he apologized, then went off skiing. Tell me about the whole incident with the guy at CNN.
Oh, well, he blew up in an interview with Chris Cuomo on CNN. I normally don't watch the channel, but that video was just too good to pass up. He was asked about an American citizen who's been in detention in North Korea for quite some time. Is not being tried. He's not going to be sent back to the U.S. Sort of a political prisoner. He was asked whether he has any qualms about being there at a time when an American citizen is in jail, and he really stood, got defensive, in sort of a way that he'd almost internalized the propaganda that you see on the face of so many North Koreans that they're filmed for the propaganda network there. And I really was just amazed that he was able to drag a whole bunch of other basketball players there with him. And if you watch the interview, I think some of the people who maybe were paid to come on the trip or something are sort of staring at him as he's completely flipping out. He's holding this cigar as he's doing the interview, obviously covered in all the tattoos and piercings that he's famous for, and the crazy hair and the clothing, the accessories and whatnot, and wondering, why did I ever come on this trip? And I really wish I could just run out of this television shot because my reputation is being dragged down as far as Dennis Rodman did now. He's certainly not going to ever, I think, be forgiven by American citizens when he returns here.
It better be an awful lot of money. That's all I can say. It better be a ton of money.
It may well be, but I saw somewhere online a psychologist doing sort of a armchair analysis of him, saying he's very depressed, he doesn't feel loved, that's the reason he's there, and I don't want to make fun of anyone who may be depressed or have a mental illness, but boy, he doesn't get any sympathy from me. And I think him being there, we could draw a parallel to other of America's enemies and what it would be like in those times to go over there and be a part of their propaganda machine. It really is an insult to the many people who have been affected by the regime there.
Yeah.
The regime that continues to operate, what many people say are 21st century concentration labor camps. I have no sympathy for the North Korean regime, and likewise for Dennis Rodman.
Or him. I'm talking about the guy who was in the shot, who's just had to make a living going to play basketball. That's the guy feel for. He got pulled into a situation he didn't sign up for, so it better have been a lot of money. That's simple.
I think we're willing to cut those guys a little bit more slack if they come home and give an apology on the tarmac and say, "Boy, we didn't know we were getting into." I don't think Dennis Rodman carries anywhere as much power back here in the States as he does over there in North Korea.
I say keep him. It's that simple. Luke, it's always great talking with you. Appreciate the time, man.
Pleasure as well. Take care.
Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Have you had your daily minimum requirement of triclosan today? How about your dosage of triclocarban? Chances are you have, but don't know it. These two are antimicrobial chemicals, which might sound like a good thing.
except that they disrupt the human body's normal regulatory processes. Animal studies show, for example, that these triclos can be linked to the scrambling of hormones in children, disruption of puberty and of the reproductive system, decreases in thyroid hormone levels that affect brain development, and other serious health problems. Yet corporations have slipped them into all sorts of consumer products, pushing them with a blitz of advertising that claim the antibacterial ingredients prevent the spread of infections. The two chemicals were originally meant for use by surgeons to cleanse their hands before operations. But that tiny application has now proliferated like a plague, constantly exposing practically everyone to small amounts here, there, and everywhere, adding up to dangerous megadoses. Triclosan and triclocarban were first mixed into soaps. But then, boom, brand-name corporations went wild, putting these hormone disruptors into about 2,000 products, including toothpaste, mouthwashes, fabrics, and, most astonishingly, even into baby pacifiers. Today, use of the chemicals is so prevalent that they can be found in the urine of 3/4 of Americans. They also accumulate in groundwater and soil, so they saturate our environment and eventually ourselves. One study found them in the breast milk of 97% of women tested. This is Jim Hightower saying, for decades, corporate lobbying and regulatory meekness let this chemical menace spread. But now, the Food and Drug Administration is finally questioning the continued use of the two triclos. For more information and action, go to the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
There was a controversial remark made by a member of your legal team comparing gay marriage to the union of 12-year-olds, saying both are illegal, which you called inappropriate.
It was an inappropriate analogy. You know, I think a much better analogy would have been brother and sister, don't you?
I don't know.
Well, we need
to. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Every time I hear that, I just kind of stop and go, yeah, you made one bad statement and followed it up with one that was worse. Oh, welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app. Take the program on the go. Always great to have our podcast listeners chiming in. And again, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do appreciate the email. In fact, got an email from one of my friends who is a gun enthusiast and identifies himself as such, but he sent me this story that says not even he can defend it. Evidently, a school board member in the town of Brookfield, Connecticut, thought it would be a great idea. Thought it'd be a good idea on the days before Christmas, because you know the 24th or the 14th of December is when the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting happened. So they had 26 days of remembrance for the 26 people to go from the 14th through the end of the year, and they were asking that people do acts of kindness for those 26 days, you know, as kind of a memorial, kind of to remember. And look, a fantastic idea. Well, this guy who was evidently just elected to the school board in November, decided that he, under the, and this is kind of the party that he was elected under, is kind of a offshoot of the Republican Party. They claim to be, more centrist, fiscally conservative. You know, I would think it's more the moneyed interests who say, we don't want to pay for education, so we'll figure out how to put these people on the school board so that our taxes don't go up and, well, screw those kids. But the A. Brookfield Party, which is, you know, the offshoot of the Republicans, because evidently the town is heavily dominated by Republicans. Evidently he thought it'd be a good idea for days 1 through 6 to hand out ammunition. Gonna hand out bullets for the, that's his act of kindness. There you go. Anyway, again, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com, Stitcher on your smartphone. It's always great to have you tuning into the program. We'll see you back here tomorrow and talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. That is going to be huge. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide that flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous rain.